Okay, welcome back everyone. You are listening to The Truth Tank. I am your host, The Tank. Tonight's show is a very special Christmas bonus show. It's my gift to you, the listening audience. We're going to have a break from the Mayan calendar. Part 3 of the Mayan calendar will be available mid to late January. Apologies for the delay. It's just the history episodes take a lot of research and a lot of time to produce, and I like to get things right and factual before I release them, hence the name The Truth Tank. I couldn't really call myself The Truth Tank if I didn't have a focus on the truth. So, as I said, tonight's show is a very special Christmas episode. Tonight, I will be reviewing Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. So, it goes without saying that tonight's episode is going to contain spoilers. So if you haven't seen The Rise of Skywalker, or you plan to at some stage and you don't want to know what happens, please tune out now. You can go to the back catalogue of The Truth Tank and download a quality Truth Tank episode for your Christmas listening pleasure. So without further delay, let's get into tonight's show. This is episode 10, The Truth Tank's review of Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. So by now you should be able to pretty accurately guess my opinion to Disney's Star Wars trilogy. I fucking detest it. I hate every fiber of its existence. It's an insult to Star Wars and true Star Wars fans. There's some aspects of it that I don't mind, and there's other parts of it that I completely detest. So let's get into the problems with The Rise of Skywalker. The Rise of Skywalker is the final film in the Disney trilogy, if you haven't guessed by now. Right from the start, it is a complete clusterfuck. I can think of several words I could use to describe The Rise of Skywalker. Messy, rushed, nonsensical, complicated, mashup, fan service, unoriginal, cold, corporate, big, gigantic blockbuster, tons of special effects, no plan, no story, and no soul. You could have probably guessed by now that this movie was beyond saving. Any way you look at it, it was going to be a complete disaster. The Rise of Skywalker's problems start right from the opening credit crawl. They stick out like a sore thumb. There might as well have been a big neon sign over the ridiculous plot points that are brought up. The credit crawl reads like it was written by a 15-year-old, and it's probably not too far from the truth. Colin Trevorrow's juvenile storylines are all over it. Colin Trevorrow, for those that don't know, directed and wrote Jurassic World. He also wrote Jurassic World: The Fallen Kingdom, which was a fucking flaming pile of shit. Colin Trevorrow's juvenile traits are all over it. However, he's not all to blame. It was written by four or five people: J.J. Abrams, Colin Trevorrow, and several others that I couldn't give two fucks to remember. Colin Trevorrow isn't a bad director, he's just a fucking shit writer. So the plot points are so dumb, it comes off as the dead speak, basically setting up the arc for Emperor Palpatine's return. Now, before this came out, there's a lot of leaked scripts and leaked stories of where this plot was going. There was two that were circulated around. Unfortunately, one of them turned out to be pretty accurate, which was the worst of the two. So right from the credit crawl, you just get this overwhelming, sinking feeling in your stomach that there is really no hope for this film. Which is no surprise given the way The Last Jedi ended. So the dead come back. They've been controlling things from the get-go. Rey is the last hope for the Jedi Order, even though she is not technically a Jedi because she hasn't been trained by anyone and she hasn't gone through the trials. Kylo Ren is now the supreme leader of the First Order and is on the warpath, going through the galaxy, getting rid of any threats to his empire. Really fucking original. So now they've decided that Kylo Ren is going to be the bad guy for the third film. This guy has been so neutered in the first two films, by the third one he's not fucking scary or intimidating. It waffles on a whole bunch more generic, cliched story outlines. in an attempt to generate some excitement for the lackluster affair that is to follow. From memory, I think there is something about a spy in the First Order ranks, and they're trying to contact the Resistance or something. I was pretty much rolling my eyes throughout this. It was so fucking dumb and so generic, which is pretty much how I thought it was going to go. So the first couple of scenes are pretty nostalgic Star Wars. There's TIE fighters flying across the screen. Finn, Poe and Chewie are in the Falcon flying around, trying to make contact with a spy. Trying to make contact with a friend of the Resistance. We don't really know much more about this guy. They fly through some red thing into some type of weird ice crater or some old ice base on. It's not quite a planet. It's more of an asteroid or something. So they make contact with another ship. There's a data transfer revealing there's a spy in the First Order that wants to help the Resistance. They get the information. Bunch of TIE fighters show up, shoot at them. They get away. There's a couple red flags that come later on. They jump to light speed and in an attempt to outrun the TIE fighters. The TIE fighters follow. They make jump after jump, which really just feels like a filler scene. It's pretty stupid. Anyone who would know anything about Star Wars would know, well, you probably burn out the hyperdrive in doing this. The coordinates are only half set. They end up in the middle of these giant pipes, right in front of asteroids. It was very stupid and very, very ballsy thing to do. The TIE fighters follow, which I haven't really looked into First Order TIE fighters, but the TIE fighters from the originals never had hyperdrives on them. They were too small. So how the fuck do they keep up with the Millennium Falcon? The Falcon lands on a planet on fire, which the Resistance has inhabited. We don't really find out much about this planet, or maybe we do and I just didn't care. It's a foresty type of planet where we're reintroduced to Princess Leia. And I've got to say, I'm usually not too picky over things like this, but the Carrie Fisher visual effects were fucking heinous. The ones from Rogue One were a lot better. Her facial movements and mannerisms seem very mechanical and very dull. It doesn't seem like it's very good effects. So the Millennium Falcon's on fire, so the Falcon pretty much crash lands on fire. We're introduced to 3PO and all our favourites from The Force Awakens and Last Jedi. Snap Wexley's back, everyone's favourite bearded pilot. Kylo's intro to the film is him on a planet that's in a burnt forest, oppressing a bunch of local aliens of some kind. He uses some questionable lightsaber moves, such as turning his back on his enemy. He slaughters a lot of these creatures along with stormtroopers. The purpose of his visit to this planet is to find an old chest that is in the middle of this scorched forest, which contains a Sith compass. This is a very important part of the story, these Sith compass things. It's funny because the first two films in Disney's trilogy pretty much tried to do its own thing. The Sith were only really a side note, and now we've come to the third film and basically all the original ideas are gone, so we have to come up with a very fan-servicing, very, very nostalgic and very cliche story based on important plot points of the original and prequel trilogies. So he gets this holocron, he goes to the Sith planet of Exegol. And to my knowledge, Exegol is a different planet to the original Sith planets described in the expanded universe, and that's generally known with fans. I guess because Disney completely shit on the expanded universe and destroyed it, making it part of Legends and not the canon, and they can kind of do what they want. So we get to Exegol. Kylo arrives, he walks into this ancient looking cave where we find a bunch of black robe, black hooded figures that kind of resemble the Emperor. He walks past, he hears these voices calling to him, explaining that it was the Emperor that has been manipulating Kylo since he was a boy. It was the same Emperor that created Snoke, a very convenient plot-filling point from the last two films. He walks past a tank with these Snoke clone things in him. So, it basically tells us that Snoke was a creation of the Emperor, and he's some type of clone, but a clone of who or what isn't exactly elaborated on further. It also sets up the rest of the film, that pretty much every question that has been raised in The Force Awakens or The Last Jedi needs an answer. In other words, J.J. Abrams didn't like the answers Rian Johnson gave in The Last Jedi, and he felt that he had to answer them as generically and as unoriginally as possible. J.J. also feels the need to answer every little question from The Force Awakens. All the mystery boxes that he created all need to be answered in this film. It probably would have been better if they had left some things a mystery or just completely have gone the other way with them. Not everything needs an answer, a question, or an origin. Dark Knight has proved this. The Joker is a scarier character, not knowing where he came from. However, if you do a standalone Joker film like the one that was released this year, it can work knowing where his origins came from. But the no-origin Heath Ledger Joker is scarier than the Joaquin Phoenix. I still like the film. It was a very good film, The Joker. It's just my personal preference. This is very much in the same kind of vein. We have to answer every question with very generic, let's try and win the original fans back, let's link it to the original trilogy answers. So it's under 10 minutes into the film, and now the Emperor reveals himself. The Emperor is some type of mangled clone that is attached to some type of life support crane thing. He's in the middle of a giant auditorium. Kylo threatens to kill him, and then the Emperor says, "You'll bring the one that carries the torch of the Jedi," or something along those lines, "and you will bring her to me, you'll kill her, and then you'll be able to take over the galaxy unimpeded." The Emperor gives Kylo Ren a couple of resources in order to do this. He conjures up a fleet of original trilogy Star Destroyers, using the Force to pull them from the ground and raise them up into the sky. Begs the question, why were they buried and how were they buried? But this is a J.J. Abrams movie, so logic and sense kind of don't mean much. He also tells Kylo Ren, take the new Sith fleet, and with this final order, you'll conquer the galaxy or something like that. He tells Kylo to take his Sith fleet and begin the final order, which is one of the most unoriginal fucking names for anything in the Disney trilogy, and is by far one of the most laughable moments of The Rise of Skywalker. The final order. We start a trilogy off with the First Order and it ends with the Final Order. Real fucking original, JJ, and the fucking Muppets who wrote this shit. Kylo sets out to reforge his mask. The Final Order fleet sits above Exegol, waiting for the final battle to begin. At this stage, Kylo Ren still doesn't have his mask on. We are reintroduced to the Knights of Ren. So, they waited to the third film of the trilogy to really give the Knights of Ren a proper introduction, and that's pretty much all we get. That's pretty much all we get about them, is just a very basic introduction. There's no explanation as to who or what they really are. They're just six guys in semi-matching black outfits and masks with some very ancient-looking weapons. Kylo remakes his mask with the Knights of Ren. There's a chimpanzee type of alien reforging it. I don't know why they couldn't have just made another helmet that another mask that looked the same. This one has these red scars on it for whatever fucking reason. It's really stupid. It doesn't look that good. It would have been better if it was just the original mask without the red texture on it. So Kylo's got his mask back on. He's back into badass mode. He throws the severed head of the Resistance collaborator on the table. This is where we're introduced to the new generals of the First Order, one of which is played by Richard E. Grant, who plays a very originally titled General Pride. I couldn't have thought of any more original names. But no, this is basically setting the benchmark for the rest of the movie. Generic, unoriginal, fan-serving, nostalgic, corporate shit. Kylo senses some type of anxiety in General Hux. He doesn't seem to like Kylo's unimpeded rule. Probably because General Hux is a fuckboy who wants to be this great leader, but is basically a half-assed attempt at a First Order officer. So this scene above all might as well have had a giant flashing neon sign above it saying generic character plot right here. This sets up something that happens later on in the film that's really generic. It's so obvious and so fucking unoriginal and so painful, because the scene only reinforces that the first leak story was right all along. It's a very basic and very obvious character point they're trying to insert here. Also makes you wonder, if Kylo could sense hesitation in Hux, why couldn't he have sensed who the traitor was? Before I go any further, there's one other describing word I forgot to mention. Predictable. The Rise of Skywalker is very, very, very predictable. So now we get our introduction to Rey. Rey is pretty much wearing the same thing she did in the last two films, except this time it's all white, which should give you an indication as to the character arc she's going to go on. There's no confliction with this character whatsoever. She is virtuous and pure, and is basically incorruptible. Unlike Luke in The Return of the Jedi, who was wearing black, you kind of don't know which way he's going to go right until the very end of the film. Anakin is basically the same. He wears dark colours. He gets away from the traditions of the Jedi, from wearing the brown or light-coloured robes and tunics. Luke has got this all black outfit. He's got a black cloak. You kind of know which way he's going to go, but at the same time, there's always a little room left in there that he could go the complete other way and join the Emperor and Vader. We don't get any of this in a conflict with Rey, which has pretty much been the backbone of the Star Wars stories, is this confronting and facing conflict, whether it be external or internal conflict. There's none of that with Rey. She's very still the same old Rey, still the same boring, pretentious, perfect Rey that knows it all and can do it all. So Rey is with Leia. She is attempting her training. She goes on an over-the-top Jedi training through this forested world. She has this helmet, which is a little nod to Luke's from A New Hope. She has a vision of her turning dark and her sitting on the throne of the Sith. This is where this double-edged lightsaber wielding Rey comes in. She's wearing a black robe. She has a lightsaber that... She has a double-ended lightsaber like Darth Maul's that folds up into a double-ended lightsaber pair of scissors, pretty much. She's fighting herself, much like Luke does in The Empire Strikes Back. And that's another massive problem with this film, is it's like every 3 to 5 to 10 minutes they reenact a classic scene from the original trilogy. They even have aliens, vehicles, and locations from the original trilogy in it. Right from the get-go, the JJ nostalgia train is full steam ahead. And this is one of the most irritating and frustrating aspects of the film for me, is just the constant reliance on original trilogy material. So just like Luke, there's now an apparent inner conflict within Rey. She's seen herself on the throne of the Sith and needs to stop it, because the uncorruptible little Miss Perfect couldn't possibly have a dark side or a dark streak that would give the story any type of dramatic undertones. I forgot to mention it earlier. The first time we meet Rey, she is cross-legged, floating in the air, levitating a bunch of rocks around her while meditating. I found this a little insulting, considering Luke struggled lifting a few rocks. But then again, Little Miss Perfect lifted tons of rocks and boulders in the end of The Last Jedi without any effort. So she's pretty much been set up as the most powerful force user that has ever lived. let's disregard the whole Skywalker bloodline at this point. She has flashbacks of her parents, and she needs to go on a quest to find answers and stop the Sith from rising. I think it's at this point she has a vision of Kylo and the Sith compass. She's pretty much figured the whole backstory with the Sith out by this point, so she's now conflicted. She senses that she has to go do something. She needs to stop this future event from happening. Where have we seen this before? Revenge of the Sith, Empire Strikes Back. They're using a very worn out plot motivator and a very cliched story arc at this point. Rey approaches Leia and tells her that she cannot complete her training. It's around this point that Poe, Finn and Chewie return on the Falcon with news of a spy in the First Order. It's pretty clear from the previous scenes that Leia has been training Rey in the ways of the Jedi. Rey being trained would have been really good to see in some of the previous films, like in The Last Jedi, how she goes to the island to seek Luke's training, but he turns out to be a grumpy old hermit. I think Poe or Finn mention the information about the spy in the First Resistance, and the planet Exegol is brought up. Rey gets one of Luke's old Jedi books, one of the books that she saved in The Last Jedi. She opens it and finds a reference to Exegol. She tells Leia that Luke attempted to find Exegol once, but had just failed. She then works out the series of events needed in order to find its location. I think the Sith Holocron is mentioned in this book, and that's how Rey knows how to find it. She also makes a connection between the ship that abandoned her on Jakku and the unknown ship in the vision she had. She works out if she can find the location of the ship, she might be able to find a clue in order to find the planet's location, or something along those lines. I kind of zoned out this part, and I don't really remember this scene very well. I can't quite remember what the motivator to get the book was, but I'm pretty sure Exegol is brought up by either Poe or Finn. Rey has her mission. She knows she has to find the ship that dropped her off on Jakku. She knows the ship belongs to the alien that appears in the vision, and that he has some type of connection to her parents. She also knows that this mysterious figure might have something to do with the Emperor or the Sith, and may have information on how to find Palpatine and or stop the Sith from rising. He also might have information on the Sith Wayfinder. For whatever reason, I can't quite remember. That's neither here nor there. So let's move along. She says she's leaving and she's going on a dangerous mission by herself to recover this second Sith Wayfinder thing. Finn stops her, and Finn being Finn says, "Oh, you're going, but you're not going alone." So Poe, Finn, Rey, Chewie and 3PO get on the Falcon, which is somehow not on fire at this point and is somehow flyable, leave for a desert planet. This planet might as well be like every other desert planet that we've seen in the sequel so far. It's a Tatooine-esque planet. It's also at this point in the film you realise anything original is completely gone out the window and not going to happen. It follows so closely the outline of Return of the Jedi, it's not funny. They've borrowed heavily from Return of the Jedi, which should be no surprise because The Force Awakens was just a retelling of A New Hope. Last Jedi borrowed heavily from The Empire Strikes Back, and this is pretty much in the same vein as the previous films. So they go to this planet, they're looking for a ship which was once piloted by an alien of some type who has a connection to Rey. She says she's seen the ship before, which once again arrives straight back at The Force Awakens. This is the same ship that it is seen departing Jakku and leaving a young Rey behind in the hands of Anklor Plot. Whether this was JJ's original idea, it's kind of hard to tell. Did he originally intend to have this alien be the pilot of the ship all along, or is this just another convenient... Let's answer the question with another question. This ship is just another loose end from a previous film that needs to be tied up and answered neatly in this film in order to accelerate the plot further. Up until this point in the film has been frenetically edited. There are so many cuts in the first 20 or so minutes, it's fucking ridiculous. The pacing of the film is all over the place. It's very rushed. They have all these jump cuts in the first part of the film. It completely ruins the pacing and continuity. There are several hundred cuts just in the first 20 minutes alone, which only really serve to destabilize the rest of the film. The best way I can describe this is like watching a Michael Bay film. He has a very frantic, very staccato-like editing style. I know he doesn't edit the films, but he approves them. So if you remember like the action in Transformers, where any action scene or sequence has so many edits, it just becomes one blur of one giant colourful screen with Optimus Prime or Bumblebee rolling through a scene, a whole bunch of shit blowing up, and you can't really differentiate between one scene to the next. It all becomes very blurry and very mindless. Unfortunately, Rise of Skywalker does exactly the same thing. The pacing of the start of the film is so frantic and so energetic, it completely destabilizes the rest of the film at this point. The first part of the film very quickly ties up as many loose ends as possible, left over from the first two films. Rey's parents have been brought back into it. Snoke's loose end has been tied up. Now we have the Emperor thrown back into the mix. Kylo's putting his mask back on. The Knights of Ren have been chucked back into it. Hux's flawed character arc from The Last Jedi is being inserted back into the film to be tied up later on. There's a whole bunch of shit that's been put into the first half of the film that really didn't need to be there. We've had the Emperor shoved in our face as the new bad guy because Ryan killed the last one. Kylo is now the bad guy that he was kind of meant to be all along but never really was. Rey's parents are now brought up again. The ship from The Force Awakens has been inserted conveniently back into the plot, like we needed any more loose ends to tie up. So basically the first half of the film is just, let's tie up some loose ends, which is really sad because it seems that the loose ends from the previous films are the driving force behind the story in The Rise of Skywalker. In other words, there's no new ideas, no originality, and the writers were so fucking shit they couldn't come up with anything else that could have possibly made this, even just that little bit, original. But at the same time, Disney has just thrown buckets of money at this, hoping that it was going to pay off. It's a little too early to tell yet, but The Rise of Skywalker is probably going to make billions of dollars and be a commercial success, either way you look at it. Regardless of whether the film is good or not, they've already made enough money out of it already, and at the same time, they're probably going to make even more money by the time this leaves theatres. J.J. Abrams, Kathleen Kennedy, Lucasfilm, and Disney have just done what they've done all along with this new trilogy, as they've played it safe. They've relied on cold, corporate, nostalgia-driven drivel in an attempt to lure fans back to a franchise that is, at this point, all but dead. So getting back to the film, they arrive on a very generic desert planet, searching for this ship that may contain the location of Exegol. Because Rey's going to go to the planet with the Emperor on it and save the day, even though she has no idea who or what the Emperor actually are. So they arrive at the very generic desert planet to find a intergalactic peace and love festival happening. This is basically just a Star Wars / extraterrestrial version of Burning Man. There's lots of mala beads being passed around, lots of coloured fireworks, lots of colourful robes, lots of peace and love. This is basically just an intergalactic hippie fest. And according to C-3PO, this happens every 40-something years, and they just happen to arrive on the day that this was happening. So they're trying to lay low. There's some very cringeworthy and very forced humour interjected into this, which should come as no surprise because there's been very cringeworthy humour inserted into all of it. So they had to lay low in the crowd to avoid any first order patrols. There's some weird alien babies who are laughing at some type of puppet show going on. Rey is interacting with aliens of all denominations. This is where she force Skypes with Kylo. Kylo is on his ship somewhere. She's on this planet. And they force Skype. So this is a little... obviously, this is a connection to Last Jedi. So it seems that JJ is willing to go with ideas suggested by Rian Johnson. Unfortunately, Rian Johnson didn't give him the same respect. I kind of hate both of them at this point, so it's kind of irrelevant. She's force Skyping with Kylo. She has a beaded necklace she's wearing. He grabs it and pulls it into the force Skype like he did in like they do in the Last Jedi. The beads are analyzed and discover that they come from this planet. Should be no surprise that he sends out some stormtroopers to go round him up. They're confronted by a stormtrooper who is basically the same stormtrooper as the one that confronts Finn and Rey in The Force Awakens, the Jakku Patrol Trooper, I think he's called. And for whatever reason, there's just one stormtrooper. Tatooine had hundreds of troops. Mos Eisley was patrolled by dozens of stormtroopers at any one time. I think each patrol is made up of at least 6 to 12 stormtroopers. And this is one lone stormtrooper holding them all at gunpoint. He's shot by a very elaborately dressed bystander who gets on a movable track wheel, which is like a movable market. And now we're introduced to Lando. So Lando has been doing God knows what since Return of the Jedi. He received a message, I think, from General Leia. He also saw Chewbacca in the crowd and decided to intervene. So bringing Lando back is pretty much just another, let's just bring an original character back into it, because we have literally no other idea at this point. It would have been really cool to see Lando back. It would have added some type of depth and weight to the film, but unfortunately he's pretty much underused for the rest of the film. Him and Chewie have a nice reunion. Stormtroopers arrive and they have to take off. They hotwire a couple of desert skiffs. There was a few things I really liked in this scene. We get our first glimpses at the backstory of Poe. Poe hotwires a skiff from some locals who aren't too happy about it. Finn questions him, "How did you learn to do that?" So there's some question marks being raised about Poe's character, which is kind of cool because he's been pretty much this perfect, idealistic resistance fighter at this point. So he finally has a couple of dark clouds over his head. Insert generic action scene at this point, which is also, strangely enough, where the film starts to slow down. It's been so hyper until this point. So we have this drawn-out generic chase through the desert. There's stormtroopers on these bike things that are tearing up the sand, which also brings up the point is, why weren't they just using speeder bikes? Because they would have been much more effective in the sand, but they're on some type of... it looks like a snow buggy that's been converted for use in the desert. The Knights of Ren arrive at this time. They're on a mission to find Rey and the artifact. I might be getting a bit confused with that. It was getting pretty tedious and my mind was kind of wandering a bit. The story was so patched together and so confusing in some points, it made it very hard to keep up with what the fuck was actually happening. So the chase ensues. This is where we get the stormtroopers, "Oh, they can fly now" line from, which was another cringeworthy attempt at humor. The stormtroopers are now flying. The jetpack troopers are attempting to land on these skiffs. They basically all fail. They all get taken out by small arms fire from either Rey or Chewbacca. None of them manage to hit the target. The skiff goes through a canyon, which is very reminiscent of the pod race from The Phantom Menace. I think there's even an identical aerial shot where you see the skiffs and the speeders snaking their way through the canyon, which happened pretty similarly in... which is a very reminiscent and nearly identical to the pod race scenes from The Phantom Menace. So yeah, more generic action ensues. There's a couple of more jet troopers that are following him, firing at him. The skiffs are destroyed. Ray kills the final jet trooper, who flies off and hits a rock and explodes rather overly dramatically for no apparent reason. So the last trooper's killed, the skiffs are destroyed, our heroes are flung from the skiffs into a patch of black pebbly sand. No one's really hurt. Ray informs them that they're in some type of sinking sand, which she just apparently is an expert on all of a sudden. They're sucked into an underground cavern. The walls are made up, have been burrowed by something. 3PO explains he knows what made the tunnels, but nobody really cares. The one thing they did get right was C-3PO. C-3PO has pretty much been underused in the first two films, but he was very reminiscent of the 3PO from the original trilogy. A very tedious know-it-all. Our heroes explore the tunnels. It's pretty dark. Needless to say, Poe turns a torch on and Rey uses a lightsaber. Whether this was intentional or not, this seems like a very, very blatant way of discrediting a male character and over-masculating and over-emphasizing a female character. Poe turns a torch on and Rey turns a lightsaber on, which for some reason is still in use, because it was torn in half the last time we saw it in The Last Jedi. So this is just another, let's ignore continuity and let's just give her a lightsaber back. It somehow magically fixed itself. But whatever, why should the audience care about details like that when the writers don't? So she lights up this lightsaber. It's a very piss-poor attempt at humor. It's basically a very blatant way of saying my dick is bigger than yours. Because Rey can do it all, and she's basically the only one that has any balls in this new trilogy, she doesn't need any help. She can do and figure out anything without any help from a man. So they continue through the tunnels. They find the skeleton of this alien that they're trying to track down. This is the same guy that's believed to have left Rey on Jakku. They go through his belongings and find a dagger. The dagger is an ancient Sith dagger that has inscriptions on the blade written in an ancient and forbidden Sith language. The inscription contains the location to Exegol. The only person that can read it is C-3PO. The only problem is his droid protocols forbid him from reading an ancient Sith language and disclosing the location. Of course, 3PO can read it, but he can't tell anyone the location. It seems pretty tedious, but at the same time, this is kind of a plot point that you could probably see happen in the original trilogy. However, it would have probably been handled differently and more realistically. So, they're confronted by a giant snake standing behind Rey, standing behind 3PO. They aim their weapons at it. Rey force senses it or something. She sees that it's injured. It's got three big gashes in its side, and this is where the bullshit gets taken up to 11. Rey force heals the snake, which is a power that we haven't seen at all from any Jedi in any of the films. Whether this is an original idea or they got the idea from expanded material, from expanded universe material, it is very problematic. So Rey is just so overpowered and just so fucking tedious at this point. She just manages to heal a giant snake, and then the snake's all friendly, then breaks a hole in its cavern and shows them the way out. So they go out, they find the ship. The ship starts miraculously after all these years. Rey senses something. She goes and stands out in the desert and she starts walking off. Why? Even if you could, you've got what you come for. Let's fuck off. So just when we get one plot point resolved, another gaping fucking plot hole opens up. The action scenes in it really only seem to just distract us for a couple of minutes, because there's nothing else the writers could come up with. They only seem to put these massive sequences in to resolve one plot point and to force the story off into a direction it doesn't really need to go, which leads to another arc in the story that is really unnecessary. It only achieves it making the running time of the film longer than it really needs to be. I mean, the film is 2 hours and 21 minutes, which is the second longest running time of a Star Wars film, The Last Jedi being the first. Finn tells Chewie he needs help. He needs the help with something, so Chewie leaves, he goes outside. He sees Rey walking off, he goes around a rock, where he's confronted by the Knights of Ren. The really dumb part about this is that this ship is not hidden underground or hidden in a cave or around a corner in a canyon or even out of plain sight. For whatever reason, the guy who was piloting it decided to land it on top of a pile of rocks. Pretty much all the terrain is flat. There's some large rocky cliffs in the background, but pretty much the surrounding area is all flat, except for the pile of rocks with the ship on top of it. So for whatever reason, Poe and Finn, when they get into the ship and start it up, they don't see a transporter with the Knights of Ren that is pretty much just next door to it, which is really fucking stupid. The Knights of Ren have pretty much landed in the barren sands right next to the pile of rocks that the ships are perched on top of. Chewie doesn't see it, Rey doesn't sense it. She senses this noise out in the desert and starts walking off. But she can't sense the Knights of Ren that are literally a couple of hundred meters away. I mean, these guys are dressed all in black in the middle of a fucking desert. They stick out like dog's balls. They're not very conspicuous. So Chewie walks around the corner. He has a run-in with the Knights of Ren, who take him prisoner. They find the dagger. They load him onto a transport and proceed to fuck off. Kylo Ren's TIE Silencer comes screaming out of the abyss and makes a beeline straight for Rey. Rey ignites a lightsaber, sees it, then decides to run in a straight line and does a triple backward somersault over it and cuts off the wing. The ship crashes and explodes. She regrets this decision soon after, realizing that she's probably just killed Kylo. Kylo steps out of the burning wreckage unscathed and makes his way towards her. Finn looks for Chewie. He sees that he's been taken hostage. He does the exaggerated Rey scream, gets her attention. They see a transporter take off. Kylo approaches. She tries to force pull the ship from the sky, which at this point should be no surprise because she can pretty much just force do everything. She's so powerful. Even if she hasn't learnt it, I mean, it took Luke, Obi-Wan, Anakin, Yoda a significant amount of time to be able to use similar abilities, but Rey, the almighty and all-powerful, self-taught, self-proclaimed Jedi, can do it all without any training or help. So Kylo weighs in. Kylo also tries to force pull the transporter out of the sky, which you think if the guy was so powerful with the force that he's just survived a high-speed crash and walked out of a burning wreckage unscathed, you think that he might have had a bit more power to bring the transporter to him. So nevertheless, the tug of war continues. This is where the problem dial gets dialed right up to fucking 12. So she's just learnt to force heal a snake. She can force pull. Now she shoots fucking Sith lightning out of her fingers and causes the transporter to be destroyed. The transporter is destroyed and crashes to Earth in a burning wreck. She screams, "No, Chewie, mate, what the fuck did you think was going to happen, bitch? You're trying to pull the thing out of the fucking sky. You got someone else having a tug of war. Did you really think that was going to work?" And then now all of a sudden she just shoots fucking Sith lightning out of her fucking fingers and destroys a transporter. Now, to my knowledge, Sith lightning was reserved only for dark side users and people in touch with the dark side of the Force. So whether this is a little nod at, oh look, she's got this dark side ability, she's channeling the dark side, whether this was a little hint at that, I'm pretty unconvinced. I'm pretty sure that that's not what the intention was. It really seems like it was just to one-up Kylo. Kylo hasn't used this ability. So the fact that they bring it in and the only other dark side user we've seen use a lightning ability is the Emperor. So, is this a little nod at Rey's origins? even though I don't think this is genetic, because Count Dooku could use Force Lightning, but this is a highly skilled ability that one needs to master, and it's all Darkseid users. So at this point that she's used this, she loses control. She loses control of her emotions and shoots lightning out of her fingers. This is highly problematic. This is reserved only for bad guys. And it's an ability that is used by Sith users to inflict pain and suffering. But then again, this is Disney Star Wars and this is a J.J. Abrams film, so all logic should be removed from the thought process. I was scratching my head at this one. It was just another confusing plot point brought in for the sake of, I don't know, trying to make this film at least somewhat interesting. There were so many things that it could have meant. The dark side being tapped into. Is she related to Palpatine? She's lost control of her emotions and this is a side effect. Who knows? There's so many fucking signifiers to that scene. It just, all it really achieves is just making it even more confusing and an even messier fucking plot. This just leaves another little mystery box to be tied up before the end of the film. So she gets on the ship, they take off and get out of Dodge. So our heroes are on the ship, they think Chewie is dead. They also realize that he had the dagger in his satchel and that all hope is lost. They realize the mission can't fail because it was the only way to find their way to Exegol. 3PO, like always, mentions that he has the inscription stored in his memory bank. Everything he reads is stored on his internal hard drive, I guess. The only problem is he can't read the inscription because it violates his protocol. Poe comes up with a plan to take 3PO to a friend of his that might be able to unlock the code in his head and get the inscription out. They make their way to the next planet, and they're followed out of an asteroid belt by the Knights of Ren. So meanwhile, Kylo gets a ride back to his Star Destroyer. General Pride informs him that they have a high-value prisoner. Chewbacca obviously wasn't killed. There were two transports in the area that no one managed to see. The first transport must have just had stormtroopers in it, because no one seems to care about stormtroopers. The Knights of Ren put Chewbacca on the second transport. So Chewie is being interrogated. Kylo Ren is now in possession of the Sith dagger, and it's now sitting in his quarters. Our heroes go to some type of snow planet that's under occupation by the First Order. They attempt to meet Poe Dameron's old acquaintance, someone who can break the code. This is a snow planet. They're sneaking around the cities at night. The First Order are oppressing and rounding up citizens in attempting to find spies. They're confronted by Poe's old acquaintance, who wants to turn him into the First Order for the reward money. He convinces her not to, and that they desperately need her help. This character is Zora Bliss, played by Kerry Russell. This is one of the only new characters I actually kind of liked. I found this character to be intriguing and reminiscent of original trilogy characters, but done in a unpretentious and kind of original way. She's basically got like kind of a tight-fitting like jumpsuit and a helmet on. She kind of reminds me of the assassin from Attack of the Clones, the shape-shifting one. It's very reminiscent of original trilogy characters, where they obviously couldn't rely on CGI to bring to life background characters. They needed people dressed in, you know, motorbike helmets with things stuck to them and jumpsuits, etc. So they bring Poe and Co. to a codebreaker who plugs 3PO in and attempts to hack his mind to get the code out. There's one problem, because there's always a problem, there's nothing ever straightforward. By getting the code out of 3PO, it will wipe his memory. This is the first time we're presented with a character that has to choose to sacrifice something in order to get the information they need to beat the First Order and for the Resistance to survive and bring peace and unity to the galaxy. So sacrifice was a very important part of the original trilogy. Luke has to sacrifice in order to try and save Vader in an attempt to save his friends. Luke is always willing to sacrifice himself to save his friends, and vice versa. So this is the first time that really anyone has had to make any type of sacrifice. And it's the fucking droid. None of the human characters have really sacrificed much at this point. None of them have made any type of permanent sacrifices that might lead to death or having your mind wiped in order to obtain the information needed. Just as soon as the element of sacrifice is brought in, someone brings up that, oh, we can just plug him into an R2 unit and back up his memory, because R2 units have memory backup. And R2-D2 has 3PO's memory backed up. Another interesting thing is that R2-D2 is very heavily underused in this film. He's been heavily underused in all the Disney films, even though he is probably by far the most liked droid in the entire Star Wars universe. This is probably because R2 was George Lucas's favourite character, and Disney seems to want to piss on and destroy everything that George Lucas worked so hard to create and build. 3PO explains that the R2 memory units are notoriously unreliable, and this may not work. It will bring up the original 3PO memory the first time he was turned on, but not his current memory, so he have no recollection of who Poe and Co are. So he has an emotional, I'm taking one last look at my friends before he gets plugged in. This is also pretty problematic because 3PO was never really referred to anyone as friends. He always referred to Luke as Master Luke. He always knew where the line was. He willingly accepted that he was a droid serving humans, and not, he was not on the same level as a biological being, therefore he never had the same rights as humans or other species. So this little freak thing plugs him in, wipes his mind, his eyes go red, and we think, okay, is this where evil 3PO is going to come into it? God, please let this leak part of the story not be true. So he recites the Sith code in a language that a similar 3PO unit used in Empire Strikes Back, that one that abuses him right before he gets blown apart by stormtroopers in Bespin. As a cool little nod, that actually kind of worked. It wasn't as forced. That kind of seemed like that might have happened if he was plugged in and he was reciting this forbidden language. So they find out the coordinates to Exegol. Poe and Zorzo head for the roof to keep lookout while 3PO's having his memory hacked. They're watching the night raids by the First Order. She explains that the world has been under a First Order oppression for a while, and that people are just hanging on. The attacks are getting worse. The Knights of Ren arrive. Kylo arrives shortly after and is informed that our heroes are somewhere in the area. This is where we get a bit of backstory into Poe and his character before he joins the Resistance. There's a nice little nostalgic moment between these two where they recite Poe's life before the Resistance. He was basically a scumbag spice runner. She explains, why did you leave? You were so good at it. You left me and your friends behind. You left me, your friends, and a wealthy source of income behind. He explained that something changed in him and he needed to serve a bigger calling than just himself, hence why he needed to join the Resistance. So they go back and check on 3PO. The memory wipe is complete. They hear the message. The night raids are intensifying. The building starts to shake. The walkers start to attack. You hear some of the heavy walkers in the background, but you never really get to see them. That's the thing I've noticed about the J.J. Abrams Star Wars, is he has a lot of references to the originals. He always has these like cool wide shots, or people looking at binoculars and you're seeing like, you know, the walkers in the background. But that's as far as he ever goes. It's like that scene from The Force Awakens when Han and Finn and Chewie are trying to break into Starkiller Base and you see the walker patrols. It's a cool scene, but you don't see much more than that. This is very similar. They're overwatching the raids. You see this walker kind of in the background, but it's not one of the big ones. It looks like one of the ones the clones have from Revenge of the Sith. There's a massive shaking sound. Rey goes outside and sees Kylo Ren's Star Destroyer entering the atmosphere. The patrols are on high alert. The Knights of Ren are closing in. Our heroes realize they have to leave. Rey force senses Chewbacca on Kylo's ship. She informs the others. They decide they have to go save him. Zorzo asks Poe how he will get through the blockade. She presents him with a First Order officer's clearance medallion or a badge of some kind. I can't really fucking remember what. Don't really care. She tells him that this will get past any First Order blockade in the galaxy. He says that he's never seen one before. She gives it to him and says, use it, save your friend. He asks her to come with him and join the resistance. She says, no, my place is here. They go off, they get in the ship, and they fuck off out of there. Our heroes are making their way to the hangar of Kylo's ship. Kylo was on the planet with Knights of Ren looking for Rey. He can sense that she's been there. General Prize is informed that there's a ship entering the hangar that has First Order clearance. The token they got from Zorzo works. The ship comes flying into the hangar. For whatever reason, the hangar isn't more heavily patrolled. Two stormtroopers are dispatched to meet the ship in the hangar under the orders of General Pride. They're instructed to get the clearance papers from the crew and find out what the hell the ship's doing there. They're asking for clearance papers. Our heroes come running out of the hangar and blow away the stormtroopers. They take out a couple more stormtroopers with small arms. The stormtroopers are a couple hundred meters away, but whatever, we've seen this many times before in this trilogy, that stormtroopers can't hit shit, even though they have high-powered rifles, and our friends with their crappy little sidearms can take out heavily armed stormtroopers at several hundred meters. Now, bear in mind, in A New Hope, there's hundreds of stormtroopers in the hangar when Obi-Wan, Han, Chewie, and Luke are sucked into the Death Star. Just a comparison. So our heroes make their way down a series of corridors. They're stopped by two stormtroopers. Now Rey can use Jedi mind tricks. She uses a Jedi mind trick on them. They turn around and walk the other way. More attempt at humor. Poe goes, she doesn't use that on us, does she? Finn replies something else, which I can't give two fucks to recall what. She's used Jedi mind tricks before, but this is an ability that is used by Jedi Masters such as Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan. And yet, little Miss Perfect, who has never been trained properly, has mastered this ability, which in fairness, she did this in The Force Awakens with the Daniel Craig Stormtrooper. This is a level 8, level 9 ability, but yet sometimes somehow she can do it, and she's never been taught, but whatever. By this point in the film, you're like, yeah, okay, well, if she shot lightning out of her ass, it probably makes sense too. So at this point in the movie, it's no surprise she can seemingly do anything in the last film, so why wreck that continuity? At least that's one part of continuity they got right, is making Rey an unlikable, perfect Mary Sue character that doesn't need any help and can do everything by herself. So at least they got that right, I suppose. Finn and Poe are sneaking around the Star Destroyer looking for Chewbacca. Rey parts ways and goes off on her own to try and retrieve the dagger from Kylo's room. Poe and Finn take out stormtroopers left, right, and center. Poe cops a wound to the arm. Finn goes in to save him, and they're cornered by stormtroopers in all directions. For whatever reason, they're not blown away there and there for killing dozens of stormtroopers. It's a bit of a mystery. But they're taken into custody, and they're taken to the interrogation room where Chewbacca is being held. They tell Chewie that they only found out he was still alive, and we're there to rescue him. So meanwhile, Rey makes her way to Kylo's room. She's going through his things and she finds the helmet of Darth Vader. I've got to mention that before. This comes back into it right at the start of the film and is the catalyst for Kylo reforging his own mask, even though he doesn't need one. Rey snoops around his room. She finds the dagger. Kylo's back on the planet. He senses something, and Kylo and Rey force Skype each other. He grabs her through Force Skype, and they have a Force Skype lightsaber battle, which is something new, I guess. So we know that you can transfer objects through Force Skype somehow, and you can apparently have lightsaber battles too. They gather the troops and board his shuttle and return to his ship immediately. At the same time, Finn, Poe and Chewie are about to be executed by the First Order until General Hux enters the interrogation room. And this is where the giant neon sign starts flashing again. He asks for the blaster of one of the troopers and says, I'll do this myself. I've been waiting for this for a long time. He kills the stormtroopers and reveals himself to our heroes as the spy from the First Order. Very fucking original. That was one of the leaked plot points. And unfortunately, it came true. I think it was painfully obvious from the start of the film that General Hux was the mole. It's blatantly obvious. Hux doesn't have a lot of screen time in this movie. He basically only has a couple of minutes, if that. He has a few lines. He's not a huge part of it like he has been in the first two movies. And it should be no surprise that he's pissed off at Kylo, given the way their relationship ended in The Last Jedi. He doesn't like Kylo. Kylo doesn't like him. He wants to be the boss, but Kylo is now the boss. So it should come as no surprise that he has an axe to grind and that he's the spy. I knew it was going to be Hux. I knew they would play it safe and they would go for the obvious choice rather than the one a bit more outside the box. I was kind of hoping it was going to be the General Pride. You kind of get a feeling through Richard E. Grant's performance that this guy's got something to hide, which is also another cue for a later mystery box that comes later. Hux reveals his motivations to Poe, Finn and Chewie. He tells them that he doesn't care whether they win as long as Kylo Ren loses. All the villains and all the heroes in this seem to be so selfishly motivated for the most part. Obviously not all of them. Most of the villains seem to be selfishly motivated. I mean, where's the loyalty to the First Order? You don't care if the whole First Order goes up in smoke as long as Kylo Ren's out of the way. Hux can attempt to lead once again. Even though they have a far more competent and ruthless leader in General Pride. He also takes himself to a hangar where the Millennium Falcon has been housed. So the First Order must have taken the Millennium Falcon back on the desert planet where they first landed it. Hux asks Poe to shoot him to make it look more realistic, otherwise General Pride will know it was him that is the mole. Finn pops him in the leg and they make their way to the Falcon. Rey's on the run. She makes her way to the hangar. She's being pursued by stormtroopers. They have her cornered in the hangar, so why doesn't she just shoot lightning out of her fingers and be done with them? Kylo's shuttle enters the hangar. She's trapped. She makes her way to the force field at the edge of the hangar. She is overlooking the perilous drop to the planet below. She's cornered. The Millennium Falcon comes into frame in an attempt to rescue her. Finn is hanging out of the door of the Falcon, calling to Rey with his oxygen mask on. The boosters make their way into the hangar and blow back Kylo Ren and the stormtroopers. Kylo Ren uses the force to stay put relatively. Rey ducks. This is also another stupid scene because it should have just incinerated everybody. I mean, how hot would the boosters of the Millennium Falcon be? I mean, it stands to reason it'd be extremely fucking hot. It's pretty much an exhaust pipe after all. So if for some reason none of them are incinerated by the heat, she jumps out of the hangar in a Superman-like pose and catches Finn's hand. She can somehow breathe in the high altitude. They get on the Falcon and they fuck off out of there. Once again, this scene is eerily reminiscent of A New Hope. Some scenes are so painfully lifted from the Death Star scene in A New Hope, they don't even try to hide it. Some of the hangar scenes are nearly identical. Stormtroopers running around, doors closing, the way the corridors are configured, we've all seen it before. The Millennium Falcon sitting in a hangar, our heroes making it onto the ship and making a break for it. Another thing I forgot to mention is BB-8 doesn't get a lot of screen time. He's the droid that was built as the new R2, but he doesn't have a huge role in it as opposed to the other films. He's with Rey at the start of the film instead of Poe, which is very curious because he's Poe's droid, but he never ever seems to be around Poe. He's always with Rey or somebody else. There's a nice little reunion between those two at the start of the film. He does the whole, oh, where are you, buddy? Oh, it's good to see you, buddy. Where you been? And they, like, does BB-8 have a flashlight hidden in him so he can just fuck him and get it over with? He has a very weird relationship with that droid that borders on the droid fucking Lando from Solo. So they're in the Falcon. They jump to hyperspace. The landing gear is busted for some reason. And they crash land on stormy and oceanic planet of Kef Bur. Not Endor, as everybody thought by the trailer. This is a cool planet. I did like it. It's very hilly. There's lots of hilly, grassy fields, followed by an immense stormy ocean where the wreckage of the second Death Star lies. This is one thing I really found really frustrating about the Rise of Skywalker trailers when they first came out, is how the fuck is there so much wreckage at the Death Star? The thing was blown to fucking pieces. And there's just large chunks of it, including the Emperor's throne, sitting there intact on this ocean planet. I mean, what the fuck? The Emperor's throne is in perfect condition with the half-broken window he looks out of right behind him. I mean, the thing was fucking obliterated. The explosion was so powerful it managed to blow the remnants of the Death Star away from Endor and into surrounding planets and moons. Logically speaking, it should have been in other smaller, scrappier, more mangled pieces, or completely blown to bits and unrecognizable. But yet there's just a giant preserved chunk of the Death Star lying in the ocean. Now, this is the same time we're introduced to a bunch of furry horse-riding nomads that confront Poe and Co. The woman riding the horse, named Janna, sees that they're no friends of the First Order, and it's at this time that Rey figures out how the dagger operates. The dagger isn't just a weapon, it's actually a compass. She pulls out a lever and it resembles a 17th century nautical sextant. She holds it up on the horizon, like, again, she just figures it out. However, this scene explains why she figures it out. The shape of the Death Star lying in the ocean matches the shape of the compass that slides out of the handle of the dagger. It has several dots and a cutout piece. She holds it up to the horizon of the Death Star and it matches. She figures that's where the Sith Wayfinder is located. She tells the others, our new friends inform her that it's far too rough and dangerous for her to attempt to cross the ocean now. She'd have to wait till morning. Rey being Rey says there's no time, she has to do it. Poe asks for any parts to fix the Falcon. Janna informs them that they may have some spare parts they can use. So Rey being Rey decides to get some type of wind sail and make an attempt to go to the Death Star. Friend Zone sees this, screams at her, then chases after her like the lovable idiot that he is. Really, has he learned at this time that he's never getting any and he's going to be in Friend Zone forever? Keeps chasing after Rey, thinking she needs help, but once again, this only really seems to increase the running time because she never needs his help. Rey makes it to the Death Star. She climbs up the side of a tower and makes an impossible jump over to a ledge. This, however, does make sense because this has been established in The Force Awakens that Rey does know her way around Imperial Rex. I mean, after all, that's what she did on Jakku. She scavenged Star Destroyers and Imperial craft for parts, so she's well acquainted with the inner workings of the Imperial fleet, where things are located, how to climb them, and how to get across them as quickly as possible. This is basically the introduction we get to Rey in The Force Awakens. So it's like, that was nice to have a little connection back to her origins. It did suit the character, and it was a nice little nod at her beginnings. She makes it through a couple of corridors where you see some suits of stormtrooper armor lying around, but no skeletons in them. This is very cool. I did like the little attention to detail, seeing the lifts of the Death Star and the stormtrooper armor lying around the place. But just when we do get really nice nostalgic touches, they're taken away. We get a couple of seconds of this, and then it's back to the repetitive Disney drivel. She makes it to the throne room. We see the Empress throne, the broken window, and she's being called to her room. The door's open. Somehow it still has power, or is this the Force guiding her? Another thing I did forget to mention was The Rise of Skywalker does connect back nicely to The Force Awakens. The Force Awakens is all about the Force Awakening, more or less. This is all about the pull of the Force, or being called by the Force to do something. So there's a nice connection between the Force and Rey. She was awoken by the Force the first time, and now she's been called by the Force. That was the one positive piece of continuity that this film did manage to pull off. Which also begs the question, is why didn't J.J. Abrams just direct the entire trilogy? I mean, I had no faith that Disney was going to be able to pull it off. I did have faith that J.J. would pull it off, but I was surely let down, as were millions of other fans. So why did they hire Rian Johnson to write and direct the second film, Colin Trevorrow to write and direct the third film, fire Colin Trevorrow from directing, but he co-wrote the film? So his ideas are still around, but his vision wasn't. It would have been, for continuity's sake, it would have made more sense if they had just got him to direct all three of them. It's not like he was doing anything else. So she goes into this room adjacent to the Emperor's throne. The Sith Wayfinder is levitating in between two stands. She takes it, she leaves the room, where she is confronted none other by Kylo Ren. Kylo Ren has tracked her and is confronting her. They get into a bit of a argument and fight over the Wayfinder, and the fight ensues. The fight goes outside onto a piece of the Death Star with some cannons on it, so you can probably make the assumption that this is part of the trench or defense battery. You see some of the cool red scaffolding from the Return of the Jedi, where they're still building the Death Star. You see this in a crumpled wreck near the beach. Finn has entered the building. Him and his new friend have made it across the sea in an attempt to save Rey. For whatever reason, Finn is pretty much wearing Han Solo's costume. He has a white leather vest, a maroon shirt, and blue pants with a similar, basically an identical gun holster and boots to the ones that Han wore. It's a cool outfit. He's not Han Solo, he's anything but. He really only serves a comic relief, and he's not really good at that. Finn could have been a really good character, but he is so neglected and underwritten in all of these films. He just is basically just laughable. Poe, for whatever reason, is dressed like Nathan Drake in his adventuring attire. It looks like he's searching for gold in the jungles of South America more than he is in a Star Wars film. However, yeah, I did like his look. But that was getting a bit off topic. Getting back to it, the lightsaber fight ensues on the piece of Death Star. This scene is actually pretty cool. The cinematography is very good. It looks really cool. You got the waves crashing. You got two people having a lightsaber fight with waves crashing down upon them. There's water everywhere. There's steam. We've never really seen a lightsaber fight in water before. We've seen Obi-Wan do it in Attack of the Clones, but we've never seen a lightsaber battle in the middle of the ocean. This was actually pretty cool, and I'd have to give it 10 points for originality. It was trying something different, so you can't fault it for that. Finn makes his way up behind Rey before he's pushed back by her. I mean, this should have been an obvious sign to him that she does not need his help. Kylo and Rey go at it. This scene's pretty cool. It shows Kylo in all of his power. He gets the upper hand on Rey finally. He even seems to get the upper hand and nearly beat her. However, Kylo's character is so damaged by this point, he doesn't have any credibility. If he had beaten her in the first and second films, this would have been a hell of a lot more intense. The biggest problem with this lightsaber fight is there is no intensity. You know she's going to come out on top. You know this is just done to keep you guessing and to keep you going, oh, I think he's going to beat her. Oh, is he going to beat her? Is he going to beat her? Oh, no, he's not. Because he's not intimidating. He's not an intimidating bad guy. If he was written as a Vader-type character from the beginning of this film, the Emperor manipulates him by saying, you can finally fulfill the destiny that your grandfather couldn't. So from the get-go of this film, he is being manipulated by the Emperor to fulfill the destiny of Vader and become a better Vader, hence the reforging of the mask and the Knights of Ren. This is the complete opposite Kylo Ren to the Kylo we see in The Last Jedi. Rian Johnson only destroyed the character more by taking the mask off, trying to fix the scar up, and then coming to a stalemate with him and Rey. He also looks kind of like an idiot because he couldn't sense that Luke wasn't real and that he was being manipulated the entire time. So if he had have kicked the shit out of her in the forest in The Force Awakens and then knocked her down in The Last Jedi, this would have been a very different fight. It would have had a different intensity and a different feel. But from the get-go, you know, she's just going to come out on top, which ruins all the intensity, and unfortunately, it ruins the entire scene. It's such a cool-looking scene. It's well choreographed. It's well acted. It's well directed, but it's all ruined and all for nothing because of the first two films. It also brings about another dumb plot point from the first half of the film. The fight ensues. Kylo's got the upper hand. He knocks her to the ground. He's looking at her. He's about to take the kill shot. So at the same time the lightsaber battle's going on, General Leia senses the conflict within her son and the danger that Rey is in. This does make the scene a little more emotional. It does give it a bit more weight. But at the same time, this all comes down to how Kylo was written in the previous films. He's not evil enough to warrant the kind of redemption. He's been put pretty much a pussy so far. And this is not a fault of his own. This is fault from bad writing and directing. If he was a very evil character, this would have had a very different outcome. So she fears that he has gone so far to the dark side, he is going to kill her no matter what. And when he does knock her to the ground, you get the sense that, yeah, he is going to kill her, finally. She reaches out to the Force to communicate with him and to make one last attempt to save him. This works. When he hesitates to kill her, this is because Leia has put in his mind that he isn't the evil Kylo Ren that he believes he is. He is Ben Solo. By reaching out to the Force, however, this does cost Leia her life. She basically does Luke from the end of The Last Jedi. She dies because of the strain of the Force reach out is so high. He hesitates. He drops his lightsaber. She picks up his lightsaber and delivers a kill shot right through his stomach, effectively ending the fight. He collapses to the ground. You think, oh, well, she's finally done it. She's finally killed Kylo Ren. And then she puts her hand on the wound and heals him. So the one dumb plot point brought up in the first part of the film where she heals a snake effectively just extends the running time longer, and it's just another dumb plot point. She kills him, and yet there's no consequences for her actions, and she revives him. So original Star Wars is always cause and effect, action, reaction, and sacrifice. Luke sacrifices himself to save his friends. He sacrifices his training. There's always some payoff. Nothing ever happens for nothing. Someone has to lose something. Luke loses a hand. He confronts Vader. He finds out the truth. his whole world is shaken, but he comes back bigger, better, and stronger in Return of the Jedi. He's ready to face his fears and save his friends in the galaxy once and for all, no matter what the cost. Whenever Rey is presented with a similar choice, she never has to sacrifice anything. But when it comes to Rey, she doesn't need any help. She knows everything. She can do everything. There's no consequence, and there's no sacrifice. The hero journey is basically meaningless with her. If the hero doesn't get their ass kicked, doesn't have to sacrifice, doesn't have to make hard choices, hard decisions, or lose something along the way, by the time they've gained anything, it's meaningless. It's a meaningless journey if you get it handed to you. So she brings him back to life. She spazzes out, steals his ship, and fucks off. Poe returns to Finn. They fix the Falcon. This is where we find out that Janna is a First Order Stormtrooper, because much like Finn, she is a deserter. She and the others who follow her are all Stormtroopers that were taken as children and forced to fight for the First Order. They were ordered to fire upon unarmed civilians. They refused and defected. So that's a nice little connection back to The Force Awakens. And it's a story arc that's never really been explored in Star Wars. This would probably make a great standalone film. Defecting Stormtroopers going to fight for the Rebels. I think it would make a very good story. So they get in the Falcon and they return to Leia. And this is where probably my favourite scene in the entire fucking film happens. So Kylo gets his lightsaber, he throws it into the ocean, and he gives up his quest to be a badass and to be the next Vader. Kylo accepts his redemption and rejoins the light. This would have been a hell of a lot more dramatic. As I said before, if he was a badder, more evil character in the first two. And this is where he is contacted by none other than Han Solo. It was pretty cool to see Harrison Ford back, even if it was only for a cameo. I've said it before, Harrison Ford's my favourite actor. It was very cool seeing him back as Han Solo one last time. It kind of felt like it was fan service, but at the same time, it was an apology for the disrespectful way JJ killed one of cinema's greatest characters and one of the Star Wars universe's most beloved characters. It was really cool to see him back. He offered some words of wisdom to Kylo. It was very well acted. Harrison Ford did an excellent job. It's probably the best performance in the film. And that really galvanized the redemption in Kylo. The way he says it, the gestures. Yeah, they did a very corny flashback to the moment he was killed, which just kind of spit in the face of it a bit. It was unnecessary because everyone knows how it happened. Everyone knows how Han met his end. It was very unnecessary. It would have been a lot more emotional and a lot more confronting if they hadn't have done the stupid flashback and if they had gone straight for the emotional nerve. He puts his hand on his face the same way he does in The Force Awakens, and he really brings Kylo back to the light. That was really cool to see. So Kylo's back to the light, and Han finally gets a half-decent farewell. This did feel like an apology to fans for the way he was treated in The Force Awakens, but it was kind of nice that they acknowledge that they fucked up. At the same time, it also completely goes over ground we've seen before. They should have just given Han a proper ending in The Force Awakens and save all the trouble all these years later. And so that brings up the bigger question. When you make a film for fan service and to basically service the needs of the hardcore fans, are you losing the originality and the integrity of the film? Even though I did like the scene, it felt like a forced apology that needed to be done. Where in reality, if they had to come up with a decent outline for a story trilogy, this could have been avoided. If they just had a fucking made a good film the first two times around, we wouldn't be in this position now. And ultimately, it's too little too late, and it doesn't improve on the film at all. It doesn't make it better by having this scene in it. It makes up for things that have happened in previous films, but like I said, too little too late, it feels like an apology and a real service to fans, even if I did like the scene. So next scene, we see our heroes return to Leah. A key point I forgot to mention is Leah. There is so much happening in this fucking film, it is hard to keep up with. There are so many ins and outs and edits and cutbacks to characters and events. It's the film is really all over the place. It is a fucking mess. It's a train wreck is what it is. And it doesn't even have the decency to use any of the classic Star Wars screen wipes to transition to one scene from the other. It's just you're on this side of the galaxy 1 minute and on the other side of the galaxy the next. So Rey makes her way to Arc 2 to maroon herself on the island the same way Luke does in The Last Jedi. She burns Kylo's ship so she can never leave the island. She's throwing bits of wood at it even though it's completely engulfed. There's a pile of wood. She's throwing pieces of wood into the burning ship even though it's already on fire. It seems that the wood could probably be saved to light a fire because there doesn't seem to be a lot of trees around. So she's there with her white hood up. She's completely given up on the Jedi. She's more or less going to become a self-loathing hermit the same way Luke did. She picks up a piece of wood, throws it into the fire, and it is caught by a very familiar hand. Luke Skywalker steps out of the flames as a force ghost. But in a span of 10 minutes, we've had the Han cameo, Leia dying, and now the Luke cameo, which Leia was basically just a cameo to begin with in this film. Luke explains that he was wrong to maroon himself on the island and give up on the Jedi. No shit, that's what fans were saying all along, and the 2 years of fucking bullshit and fighting and disagreements and the splitting of Star Wars fans to those who loved The Last Jedi and those who hated it, all the name-calling, all the toxic Star Wars fan shit, it was all brought to a head in this scene. Because once again, this feels like a scene that was apologizing for the faults of previous films. Because that's what hardcore fans said all along, is this wasn't my Luke Skywalker. Even Mark Hamill had a hard time trying to portray Luke Skywalker as a grumpy old man. He said, this is not Luke. I don't know who it is, but it's not Luke. So all this scene really managed to do was piss all over The Last Jedi. I'm not really against that. Lots of fans would probably be happy about it. But at the same time, it should have been written properly in the first place. We shouldn't have had such a divisive Star Wars film in the first place. So he basically admits fault. He apologizes for being a grumpy old prick and marooning and staying on the island. He says it was fear that was keeping him there and nothing else. He says the same thing's going to happen to Rey unless she confronts fear. Because confronting fear is the path of the Jedi. This is exactly what Luke Skywalker did in the original trilogy, especially in Empire and Jedi. He explains to her that she needs to confront the Emperor, otherwise the dark side wins again, and that Kylo is not her fault. The scene with Luke is very reminiscent of the scene with Yoda and Luke in The Last Jedi. Like I said before, it seems very apologetic to fans and was necessary, but at the same time, it could have been done a lot better. I really think Luke should have been in the film from the get-go. Luke Skywalker shouldn't have had to have made another cameo in his own movie. I mean, the whole saga revolves around the Skywalkers. And to have the most famous Skywalker make just a cameo in a movie that's supposed to be about him is a little disrespectful and a little annoying. I was expecting a lot more Force Ghost Luke. After his disrespect in The Last Jedi, I thought JJ could have picked up the slack. JJ has only just proved again that he has no fucking idea what he's doing. Let's put Luke into yet another cameo. This is also the same time where Luke drops a huge bomb. He presents Rey with Leia's lightsaber. I can't remember if he presents it to her or he tells her where it is on the island and she finds it wrapped up. Anyway, she unwraps this piece of leather and finds Leia's lightsaber. It's pretty cool looking. It looks kind of like Luke's from Return of the Jedi. He tells Rey that he used to train Leia and that she too faced challenges during the Jedi trials. She had the same pull from the Force and the same call from the dark side. This is also another one of my favourite scenes. Luke and Leia training in the woods of what we assume is Endor. They've both got their helmets with their visors down. They're both having a lightsaber battle. Leia knocks over Luke, of course, because you couldn't have it the other way around with the Disney trilogy. The female always has to best the male. Even if he did stand up to Darth Vader and the Emperor simultaneously. Nevertheless, it was still a pretty cool scene. The effects are a bit off in it. Once Luke's knocked to the ground, he lifts up his visor, Leia does the same, and it reveals their post-Return of the Jedi faces. The effects are a little dodgy given how much money has gone into it. Once again, the Rogue One young Princess Leia looked a lot better. Leia's using a lightsaber, she's using the Force, and Luke gives Rey Leia's lightsaber. It's a pretty cool story arc, it's a nice little touch. I think most fans have always wanted Luke to have trained Leia. At some point, I think most fans in general wanted to see Leia become a Jedi. I think that was originally George Lucas's plan, was to show Leia undergoing the Jedi training, but for whatever reason it just didn't work out in the originals. Once again, it feels a bit like fan service. One huge problem with it is The Last Jedi becomes completely irrelevant in every way, shape, and form. Because if Luke wasn't the last Jedi, that means Leia is. And Leia has just died, so Rian Johnson fucks up again. Whether this was a conscious decision by JJ and co. to undermine The Last Jedi even more, or whether this was just a oversight by the apparently non-existent script supervisors that seem to oversee all the Lucasfilm scripts. So if I've just put that together a couple of days after seeing the film, surely someone could have picked that up. Because what are the conditions of being a Jedi? You have to be trained, you have to undergo the trials, and you have to build a lightsaber. She's done all three, and here's the lightsaber. She might not be a practicing Jedi, but she still is a fucking Jedi. So Rian, you're fucked up again. So Rey feels renewed, she feels confident that she can go save the day and confront the Emperor and save the galaxy and her friends, much the same way Luke did 30 years before. I mean, it's really fucking original at this point. It's pretty much just rehashing The Return of the Jedi, the same way Force Awakens rehashed A New Hope and The Last Jedi rehashed Empire Strikes Back. No surprises, I think pretty much 99% of fans could have probably guessed this is how this trilogy was going to play out. Cold, nostalgic, corporate-driven crap. Only problem with Rey wanting to go on a quest to save her friends is she just destroyed the only mode of transport on the island. That's another huge problem I have with these Disney Star Wars characters, is they're just typical entitled millennials. As soon as something goes wrong, they just run away, give up, burn the only mode of transport they have, and in a split second decide that they're going to live on an island for the rest of their life. Rather than take a bit of time recovering and regrouping than getting back in the fight. I mean, look how many times Poe's been fucking kicked in the guts and he keeps on getting up. He's probably one of the few Disney characters that has any type of backbone. He keeps on getting pushed around, walked all over, and yet he stays true to his course. But I know Force Ghost Luke to the rescue. They're standing on the cliffs of Ark 2, and he raises the X-Wing that is submerged in the water that was introduced in Last Jedi. The very wet and submerged X-Wing is brought up to land, and Rey gets in it and flies away to Exegol. I think the problems are pretty apparent. The thing's been underwater for fucking 20 years. How in fuck's name is it flyable? Everything would have been submerged, unless it was fucking wrapped in glad wrap. It's brought out of the water without any algae or any other type of sea life attached to it. There's no barnacles on it, there's no slime. I mean, when the X-Wing went underwater and Empire Strikes Back, it was filthy. It was covered in reeds, it was covered in muck. So Rey gets in it, puts on Luke's helmet and flies off. This is just another piece of fan service, fucking fan wank shit. So she's flying off to Exegol, everyone's back on the forested, what looks like the moon of Yavin, Resistance base, Poe and Co. arrive, the blonde-haired general informs Poe that Leah is gone, they visit a body before it transcends into the Force. Didn't know that could happen, I thought once you had died and transcended into the Force, that was it. I didn't know you could wait around for a couple of hours, then transcend into the Force. But whatever, JJ seems to be making up the Star Wars and Jedi rules as he goes along, as much as Disney has done in the last couple of films. So they pick up an X-Wing class fighter on screen, and it's making a weird flight path. Poe or Finn, I can't remember which, notices that it was Patton and says, oh, that's Rey leading us to Exegol. They all make their preparations, say their goodbyes, load up the ships, and fuck off for the battle with the originally named Final Order. Lando and Chewie take the Falcon in an attempt to rally as many supporters to the cause as possible and bring as many reinforcements to the fight. They're outnumbered about 100-1. There's thousands of Star Destroyers, which is ridiculous. They come up with a plan. Because of Exegol's atmosphere, the ships can't navigate properly and breach the atmosphere without strict coordinates from a radio tower. The problem with the Sith fleet is it's fucking huge. It's so big, it's like the trailer shots from Troy, when they had thousands of ships in the ocean and it was just unrealistic and it was so over the top, it just took away any of the reality. This is basically the same thing. There's thousands of ships all lined up, and it's just so over the top and overwhelming that it takes any of the realistic impact out of what's about to happen. So the Final Order all have their own troops in their own uniforms. They're all black with red on them. There's the gunners who have the red helmets with the black masks. There's the Sith troopers, which are red stormtroopers, which have been brought up before. There's been red stormtroopers in the expanded universe. This just seems like a really good ploy at selling toys. Come up with a couple of new stormtroopers and a couple of new uniforms and get people to buy more toys. Well done, Disney. You capitalist dogs. So the fleet has been equipped with planet-destroying cannons. It basically looks like the Star Destroyer have massive dicks attached to them. These are the similar cannons that the Dreadnought from The Last Jedi had, that has the power to destroy an entire planet. They test fire it on the snow planet from earlier in the film and blow it away. Starkiller Base was ridiculous, and they make mention of that in the film, that the overcompensation or the overpoweredness of Starkiller Base was an oversight for the First Order or something along those lines, so they thought it more efficient to attach giant cannons to Star Destroyers. Once again, probably to sell more toys. The only problem is that these things are even more overpowered than the Dreadnought. They destroy an entire planet with a few shots. It's not as ridiculous as Starkiller Base wiping out an entire solar system, but it's still pretty stupid. So, Rey lands, she makes her dash into the cave to confront the Emperor and bring peace and prosperity to the universe. Poe and Co. start the battle, they engage the ships, they're going to take out the tower. The bad guys don't know that until a few minutes into the battle, then they realize that what their plan is, and take the transmission to the lead Star Destroyer, the First Order, Kylo's First Order Star Destroyer. General Pride seems to be a somewhat competent First Order leader, which is the first one we've seen so far. Finn and Jana lead a ground assault on top of the lead Star Destroyer in an attempt to shut down the cannons. It's pretty much a massacre. Most of the ships get blown apart pretty quickly. The Star Destroyer is just destroying a bunch of small rebellion ships. There's a couple of bigger ones involved, but not much good comes out of it. We don't see any of the big Corellian ships from The Last Jedi or from previous films, whether they were all destroyed in the last one. Leia's ship, the Blockade Runner, is involved. That's pretty cool, seeing that doing some tight manoeuvres and firing upon Star Destroyers. Seems to me there should have been a lot more TIE Fighters involved. As you see, like in Return of the Jedi, with the TIE Fighters protecting the bigger ships, and Because it seems the small ships would probably have an advantage over the bigger ships. They'd be too hard to hit. So you think you want to go ship-to-ship combat, but whatever. This is J.J. Abrams and Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm and Disney. So Rey makes it into the cave. She confronts the Emperor. The Emperor tells her her true parentage. She finds out earlier in the film that her parents were killed by this mysterious alien that they had been tracking. She finds out that her parents were a part of the First Order who got out and smuggled her to Jakku before being tracked down by this alien bounty hunter guy and being murdered. Palpatine also tells her that she is a Palpatine and that she is her granddaughter. This is one of the original theories as to who she was related to. I never thought it was Luke Skywalker. I always said when The Force Awakens came out that she was Palpatine's granddaughter. So the truth tank picked it first. I always knew she was Palpatine's granddaughter, just by the way she moved in the lightsaber fights, the thrusting. The only other person to have that type of style was Palpatine in Revenge of the Sith. Doesn't mean a great deal on lightsaber techniques, but it just seemed it was a little too obvious to be a coincidence, and as it turns out, everything is pretty obvious in this trilogy. So, what a shocker, she's related to Palpatine. He gives her the same choice that he gave to Luke. Strike me down, take the rightful throne of the Empire, and you'll rule the galaxy. However, he never really gives a clear indication as to why he wants a more powerful Jedi to strike him down and take the throne. In Return of the Jedi, he wants Luke to strike him down so he'll become more powerful and, I guess, live forever as a Force ghost. Whether he's just baiting Luke or he knows that he won't strike him down, or maybe he wants to so Vader can kill him and then he can get Luke out of the way, or whatever his original plan was, seems a bit outside of his character. A guy that's so hell-bent on power and control doesn't seem like he'd want to get struck down so easily. Doesn't seem like he'd want to get killed only to come back as a Force ghost. But then again, that also connects into Episode 3, which is one of the only prequel connections it makes. Palpatine quotes the lines from Revenge of the Sith, powers that some would consider unnatural. This is about the only connection to the prequels the new trilogy has given us. Was this the plan all along? Was he just going to clone himself and come back, or was he conjuring up some type of power that if he was ever killed, he'd be able to come back gradually through spirit form back into a physical being? All the scenes with the Emperor are pretty lackluster. It just seems very generic and very fan servicey. He's on a giant crane thing, so he can't really do anything. He's not really threatening. He gives her the choice, otherwise his friends will die. He basically pulls the same trick as he did in Return of the Jedi, leading the Rebels into a trap, then firing the Death Star. Rebels are getting their ass kicked. Snap Wesley goes down in a blaze of glory and fire, which I thought was pretty funny. Poe is now the leading general, which is funny. That's another little spit in the face to The Last Jedi. The disrespectful way he was treated and how he was demoted from captain. He is now the highest ranking officer, apparently. Even though when he tried to overrule anybody in The Last Jedi, he was just walked all over. This is another little JJ versus Ryan. My film is better than yours. I'm making everything you brought up in your film irrelevant. Oh, now I'm making the third one. I'm going to make everything you did in the second one irrelevant. It's just a pissing contest between these two talentless fucking hacks. So she's conflicted. Is she going to do it? You kind of know she's not. Is she going to strike the Emperor down and take the throne? She's surrounded by yet another lot of red guards, this time with guns. You don't ever get a good look at these new red guards or really any of the background characters. It's just like the snow troops and flame troops from The Force Awakens. They just appear in the background and appear on shelves in toy form weeks before the film comes out in order to buy, even though they have not much significance throughout the movie. So Rey's standing in the auditorium. There's thousands of Palpatine supporters all dressed in black hoods and black robes. There's thousands of them that are shouting in praise of the Emperor. you never get a good look at who these people are or what they're doing. You see a couple of them working on some medical things at the start of the film when Kylo confronts the Emperor. You don't really see much more of them apart from a few glimpses. They all look like the Emperor, but who the fuck knows? Are they more Emperor clones? Maybe. Maybe the Emperor has cloned himself thousands of times, except it's not really ever elaborated or explained very well. He's got a couple of mangled fingers, which are like Snoke's hands. So is he just a weird, decrepit, mangled clone that is coming back, regenerating and coming back to life? I don't know, maybe I missed that whole point. We know cloning in Star Wars is possible, so why doesn't Palpatine's clone look better? He's all decrepit and looks like he's just come out of the grave. So in order for the Emperor to rise, for those that don't know, the Emperor needs to be struck down ritualistically by a willing opponent in order for him to pretty much jump into their body and take their life force. This allows the Emperor to take over another body. This is the same choice that he gives Luke in Return of the Jedi: strike me down and I'll become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. This is a ritualistic Sith practice whereby a willing opponent strikes down a Sith in order for that Sith, aka the Emperor, to take over the life force of the person that struck them down. This is a nod to the ancient Sith magic that is expanded upon in the expanded universe that Disney decanonized. I had to look a lot of this up because the movie doesn't do a very good job of filling in the blanks. In typical JJ fashion, we get a lot of new mystery boxes, but not a lot of answers. You don't want a lot of questions going into a third film. You want more answers. So it seems pretty clear that the Emperor created Snoke, and that Snoke was the Emperor all along. I fact-checked that, and that seems to be the official version of things. Snoke's throne room had red guards. It had red all around it. He wore a gold robe, and he had a black ring come from the lava on Mustafar. It had ancient inscriptions on it, and these were the same inscriptions that were on the statues in Palpatine's office in the prequels, and the same statues that he carried around into his lair in Star Wars Rebels. It's all the same statues you get a glimpse of when the elevator goes down on Exegol into the cloning lab. So it seems clear that Snoke was the Emperor all along. The Emperor can manipulate everything. There's a whole bunch of backstory to the Emperor. Did he create Anakin Skywalker out of midichlorians? He killed his former master, the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise. He's cheated death probably more than once. He's figured out through ancient Sith magic how to conjure up his life force and how to basically become immortal. He needs to jump from body to body, but apparently clones aren't enough. He needs a full natural-born body to be able to use up. Hence his mangled look and his need to be attached to this giant medical crane thing with all the tubes in it. He also mentions that he has cheated death in Rise of Skywalker, referring to his death in Return of the Jedi. Obviously, his body would have been blown apart by the explosion, so how did he survive? When the blue wind comes up after Vader throws him down the shaft of the Death Star 2, did he hit something, or is that his life force going out into the universe, only to find its way back? So he's giving Rey this choice: strike him down so he can absorb all of her power. And given how overpowered he is, that would give him an increasing amount of extra energy. The same way he wanted Luke to feed off his energy, the same way he manipulated and fed off Anakin Skywalker before being turned to Darth Vader. Was he planning to do the same thing there, or did he just want the apprentice? Probably just wanted the apprentice, but you know what I mean. Another key part of the story I forgot to mention is that it's brought up in The Rise of Skywalker that Palpatine has a son. His son is Rey's father, hence the granddaughter connection to Palpatine. This is the first time it's really been brought up. It's not really explained very well in the film. It's not elaborated on further. Like most of JJ's new Easter eggs, it's just another one of these ideas that's thrown out there. There's a lot of shit in this movie that isn't explained very well. You see a tank full of Snokes, so you assume he is being cloned. We don't know who these hooded figures are. There's a lot of stuff in the movie, like with The Last Jedi, that requires further reading, or you have to be a super fan to know. I had to research a lot of the stuff about the Emperor and how he came back, because not even I know that, and I consider myself a pretty diehard Star Wars fan. I haven't really read any of the Expanded Universe, but I do know a fair bit about it. So it seems convenient that Disney has destroyed the EU, non-canonized it, but they're taking stuff from it when it suits them, when they're completely out of ideas. When they're completely fucking raped a new trilogy that should have been great, they can just pick and take whatever they choose from a expanded universe that was known and loved by a majority of fans, and just mix and match and pick whatever they want from it. Palpatine having a son isn't elaborated on. It's not mentioned in the prequels or the originals. His son is killed by the alien thing. So this leaves no doubt in anyone's mind that Rey is a Palpatine. The hints are there all throughout the trilogy, but was this the point of the Sith lightning coming out of her fingers? Was this to show that she is a Palpatine? I think that's pretty stupid, considering that that's not a genetic trait just ascribed to the Palpatines. This is something that many Sith users have done, not just the Emperor. So Kylo comes running to save the day. He jumps down a giant chain of the elevator to try and help Rey, or save Rey. Who really knows at this point? How the fuck did he get there? He just all of a sudden turns up. How did he get off the ocean planet and back to the Star Destroyer? Because his ship is destroyed twice in this movie. He seems to have an endless supply of TIE fighters. There's two destroyed. He keeps on getting off of planets without any mode of transport, without any transportation. So he rushes in. He's not wearing his usual Kylo Ren stuff. He's got a black shirt and pants on. He doesn't have a lightsaber because, as I mentioned before, he threw it in the ocean. He's confronted by the Knights of Ren, who just magically are waiting for him. This is one of the other really frustrating things about this, is we do not find out who or what the Knights of Ren are. They're in it, but they never get any explanation to who they are, what their motivations are, or really anything else. Are they Sith worshippers? Are they whatever? I think through the visual dictionary, I think that I found out that they're worshippers of Darth Vader. This is a cult set up by Kylo Ren, basically a cult to his grandfather. We don't see any of them without the masks on. You don't even get a good look at them. They're just kind of these abrupt black blurs that come in and out of scenes every once in a while. So he's there, he gets the shit kicked out of him, he fights a few of them off. The Knights of Ren are using pretty normal looking weapons. Rey's still making a choice. Kylo's surrounded and weaponless. Rey force gifts a lightsaber to Kylo. It appears behind his back, and then he dispatches the Knights of Ren rather quickly. So Rey's facing off with the Emperor. She's still making her choice. She's still conflicted. It's at this moment Kylo Ren comes rushing in to aid Rey. Rey and Kylo both stand before the Emperor. Kylo has decided to help Rey, realizing that she's going up against an extremely powerful and manipulative enemy. The Emperor, being the Emperor, seizes the opportunity to use both of them for his own means. The Emperor realizes that these two are a dyad in the Force, that they're stronger together than they are apart, and given his current physical state, he decides to suck the life force from both Rey and Kylo, absorbing all their essence in order to regenerate himself. So he drains Rey and Kylo. They both drop to the floor. At this stage, they're still alive, but they're drained by the experience. So this scene in particular makes you wonder, was this part of the Emperor's plan all along? Or was this just a convenient plot hole that had been filled? So did the Emperor intend to have Rey and Kylo in front of him? Did the Emperor intend for Kylo to renounce the dark side and come back to the light? By Kylo coming back to the light, was this the only way of getting Rey and Kylo in the same place at the same time, in order for the Emperor to feed off of them? I don't know. I think this is probably more just oversight in the script department, like the rest of this film has been. Yeah, this film, if you just turn your brain off, is enjoyable enough. As a diehard Star Wars fan, there's a lot of infuriating things that happen in it. The Emperor sucks the life force out of both of them. He starts to regenerate. His fingers grow back to their normal length. His skin looks better. He starts to essentially come back to life, and he starts to regain the form of the Emperor that we last saw in Return of the Jedi. His face is healed. His eyes regenerate from the cloudy, pale white eyes to the yellow and red eyes of a Sith Lord. So the Emperor is fully regenerated. He detaches himself from his life support crane thing and is now regenerated back to his original form and standing in front of Rey and Kylo. The Emperor has finished using Kylo and Rey. The power of these two is no longer as great as it was before he did the soul suck. The Emperor has finished with Kylo Ren. He has served his purpose and outlived his cause. The Emperor discards Kylo by force pushing him backwards off of a ledge to what we believe is his untimely death. Rey is now left to face the Emperor by herself. Palpatine now reclaims the Sith throne. He takes his seat momentarily on the gigantic stone throne that is very reminiscent of Snoke's throne. It's pretty cool. I want one. Palpatine believes he has sensed hatred and anger brewing inside of Rey. He believes if he can manipulate Rey into ritualistically striking him down, he believes that his soul will reside in Rey, along with the thousands of other spirits of Sith Lords that have come and gone over the years. Rey's life force is drained and she drops dead on the ground. I probably would have given this review an extra star if she had remained dead, but deep down I knew that that wasn't going to happen. Kylo's being discarded off of a ledge. Rey lies deceased on the ground, or what we're led to believe is deceased Rey. The Emperor thinks he's won. Then after a couple of moments, we hear some familiar voices. We hear the voices of past Jedi, the force and spirits of thousands of generations of Jedi start to conjure up and manifest in Rey. They start pushing her back to her feet. There's a spark of life, and she comes back to life with the spirits of thousands of Jedi pushing her on. Little Miss Perfect, Goody Two Shoes Rey, isn't falling for it. She knows the Emperor's game and what he's up to. The Emperor rises from his throne and attacks Rey with Sith Lightning. In an attempt to conjure some hatred up out of her and get the retaliation that he wants for her to strike him down. This is the same card he pulled on Anakin and Luke. The Emperor blasts Rey with Force Lightning. The Force Lightning is a lot more extreme than we've seen in previous films. He's gone for broke in his attempt at electrocuting Rey. Rey blocks the Emperor's Sith Lightning with a single lightsaber. She holds it up in front of her, deflecting both barrels of Sith brutality. This scene is about as dramatic as watching paint dry. It's not dramatic, it's not intense. It should be. At this stage of the film, it should be. It should have been really intense. But there is no sense of urgency or drama with it. The Emperor just blasts her with lightning. She blocks it all. She's just standing there, perfectly still, absorbing everything the Emperor's throwing at her. It would have been a hell of a lot more dramatic if she was blown back by the lightning, and if she had to use two hands to push against it, as one would think. If she was getting pushed back towards the ledge, it would have added some drama, some intensity, to an otherwise pretty bland scene. She just stands there and just takes it. The Emperor's just throwing everything he has at her. By blowing Rey back, this would have demonstrated the power of the Emperor, and that Rey was in real peril for once. But oh no, you can't do that. You can't have Rey get upstaged by the Emperor. You couldn't possibly have her be overpowered by someone else, even if the Emperor is supposed to be one of the most powerful beings in the universe. I mean, he's only conquered death twice at this point that we know about, and manipulated the entire galaxy three times now. So why would you want to display the Emperor with any kind of real power? But I know you can't have the old white male beat Rey. This wouldn't be politically correct enough for Disney. She's absorbing the Sith lightning much the same way Mace Windu did in Revenge of the Sith. The main difference between those two scenes is that there's a sense of drama and intensity. When the Emperor blasts Mace Windu, he absorbs the lightning, but there's a sense of danger to the scene. Yeah, he uses one hand to deflect it, and he moves closer to the Emperor. The Emperor is in a defeated position on the ground, but this only helps to intensify the scene. The Emperor is basically a wounded animal, and he's more dangerous than ever. And he's also managed to completely suck everyone into this sense that he is somehow vulnerable and defeated. He's luring Mace Windu into a trap. And it pays off because it's the same moment that Mace Windu reflects the lightning back onto the Emperor, disfiguring him. This is the same moment that Anakin Skywalker walks in and believes that Mace Windu was trying to kill him. And we all know the rest of the story after that. So with Rey, there's none of that. Lightning battle intensifies. Rey is now having trouble blocking the lightning, so she uses a force to pull Kylo's lightsaber to her. Or her own lightsaber, or Leia's lightsaber. I can't really remember. Rey has both lightsabers. She crosses both the lightsabers over in front of her in a X-shaped pattern in order to block the Force lightning. She begins to move forward using this cross motion to deflect the Emperor's lightning. She pushes closer and closer to the Emperor until she is right in front of him. She reflects the lightning back at the Emperor, and the outcome is pretty similar to Revenge of the Sith. The lightning electrocutes the Emperor and starts to disintegrate him. It's a bit more dramatic and over the top than Revenge of the Sith. The lightning disintegrates the Emperor in front of Rey. He pretty much melts and dissolves into nothing. There's one scene where his face is melting that is very reminiscent of the finale of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's good to see that Lucasfilm poaches ideas from other Lucasfilm movies. So the Emperor's dissolving, his face is melting, and he basically blows up and disintegrates into nothingness. This scene also borrows from The Last Crusade, where Donovan drinks the water from the wrong grail and ages rapidly and explodes into dust. So they've more or less copied two other Lucasfilm movies. Well done, great originality. It still isn't dramatic or intense, it's kind of just very plain and very boring. So Rey has defeated the Emperor, and if you're wondering why hasn't the Emperor's soul jumped into Rey, well, the big twist with the scene is that Rey doesn't really kill the Emperor. Palpatine kills Palpatine. She is merely reflecting his own power back at him, and his arrogance, his short-sightedness, and his desire for power have blinded him to a pretty obvious flaw in his plan. He's defeated by good, and really you'd think that he would probably have learned his lesson by now, because this is the second time this has happened. Vader's compassion and love for Luke destroyed the Emperor in Return of the Jedi, so you think Palpatine would have his guard up when it came to poetic endings, because really he was undone by the same thing 30 years ago. His plan was so foolproof that he was undone by such a simple coincidence or a duality in the Sith ritual. So Rey doesn't strike the Emperor down, therefore the ritual is not complete, and Rey keeps her hands clean once again. This is pretty obvious. I think most people could have guessed this is how this film was going to play out. And like I said before, there is no sacrifice and no consequence to any of these new characters' actions apart from Poe. Rey still doesn't have to deal with consequence, sacrifice, or loss. She merely beat the Emperor by his own arrogance and oversight, and therefore she doesn't take any of the weight on her shoulders. So Rey is not a Sith Lord, she's still a goody two-shoes, and still pretty boring. So his own greed killed him. This, however, does take a toll on Rey. She is basically drained at this point, and she collapses dead on the ground again. I had my fingers crossed that she was going to stay down this time, but figured JJ, Disney and Lucasfilm were going to play it safe and have her be resurrected somehow. So she's lying there dead, and like I said before, I probably would have given this film another star if they had have done something original. At the same time, the Resistance are getting their ass kicked. Finn and Jaina are being blown to pieces. The Space Horses running up the Star Destroyers are getting wiped out. Dominic Monaghan is getting his ass kicked. I forgot to mention him. He mentioned something very interesting in passing during the film. He says that something along the lines of who knows what the dark Sith magic was conjuring up, making a reference to cloning and the other twisted things the Emperor and the Sith were up to. That's a key point, is that a lot of the stuff the Emperor's up to is all based in Sith magic, which has never really been explained. It wasn't really mentioned in the original trilogy, nor the sequels. This is something that you had to find out through the expanded universe or doing your Star Wars research. So she kills the Emperor, sets everything right. Meanwhile, the Resistance is getting its ass kicked by the final order fleet. There's only a few fighters left. Then they get a radio call from Lando. General Pride is notified that thousands of ships have just entered the atmosphere. He says, how can there be a navy that size? And they said, it's not a navy, it's just people. Thousands of ships turn up. It's actually a pretty cool scene. The whole sky is full of a motley crew of ships from all over the galaxy that have come to lend support against the Final Order and finally bring peace and prosperity to the galaxy. The ships blow apart the Final Order fleet. Yeah, it's a bit weak. It's very over the top, but very underwhelming. I didn't really feel very satisfied with it. The dogfights aren't very good. It follows the same formula as Return of the Jedi. There's the Vader-Luke battle, which is the Rey-Palpatine battle, the Han and Leia on Endor, you got Finn and Jaina on the Star Destroyer, Poe and the Resistance leading the aerial fight, which is Lando and Ackbar. There's no real emotion to it. I didn't really feel emotionally invested in the film really at all. A few parts with Leia and Han and Luke, it was a bit different, but the rest of it was just kind of very cold and very rushed, very corporate, very messy. So the fleet turns up, blows away the Final Order. Finn and Jaina, they open a hatch, chuck some grenades down there, blow up the tower or one of the something, whatever they blow up. They also get into one of the cannons that can be controlled on the deck, because yeah, that would happen quite a lot. They fire on the bridge, blow it up. General Greaves, General Pride runs towards the window before the bridge explodes. That whole sequence is very much like the last level of the story mode of Battlefront 2, when you're fighting on a Star Destroyer, you're ducking and covering. So it's basically the same thing. So Disney have no ideas left. They've got to take their own ideas from a couple of years ago from video games. It's well done. Well played. Very original. Rey is drained. She collapses dead on the ground. I was about to start clapping at this point, but you know it's not going to last very long because she's only going to come back. The fleet's been destroyed. The Star Destroyer's dropping out of the sky and crashing into the planet. Once again, this is kind of very reminiscent of Return of the Jedi, with the Super Star Destroyer going into the Death Star. Very similar, very, very heavily borrowed from Return of the Jedi. If you're expecting anything original, don't go and see this movie, because you're not going to find it. Rey is laying slumped on the ground. Kylo climbs up the ledge, as you know he's going to. He limps over, he's pretty badly injured. He gets to Rey And guess what? He uses a life transfer and brings her back to life. So apparently that's the new Force ability, is bringing back people from the dead. That's the rule. That's another thing that really pissed me off, is that there's all these like little new Force powers and that adds these little plot points that all come into play in the end of the film. This is not just a trait of Star Wars. This is done in many, many films. There's always someone, a character does something early on in the film that comes into play later on in the film. It's very cliche, it's very generic, and it's very fucking overdone and boring. She wakes up, Kylo and Rey embrace, and they finally get their on-screen kiss together. Fucking vomitous. This is very unnecessary and very stupid, because they've been trying to kill each other for the last couple of films, then they lock each other in the middle film, then they go back to killing each other. She kills him, brings him back to life. She dies, he brings her back to life. It's a fucking clusterfuck. This movie is a fucking mess. It's got no idea what it wants to do, what it wants to be. It's fucking all over the place. So then he dies of his injuries in her arms and transcends into the Force. I thought you had to be a good guy to transcend into the Force, but you know, no, apparently not. Force abilities kind of just go up and down in this movie. It just, whatever seems to suit a character or plot hole. Most of the new Force abilities are just to cover up gaping plot holes in the script or plot devices that come into play later in the film. I mean, Leia dies, then her body stays there, then it transcends into the Force when Poe comes back. I mean, come on, you can't just pick and choose. If you don't have consistency, you don't have continuity, you don't have anything that's worth taking seriously. Oh, well, you know, Rey might as well fly next scene because she has to cross a fucking a gorge or something like that. Oh, well, Kylo can actually swim underwater because he's in a fucking ocean. It's just dumb shit like that. Come up with Force abilities to serve as plot devices. To cover up the gaps in a fucking story that has so many fucking holes in it, if it was a ship, it would have fucking sunk. So she goes out, gets in Luke's X-Wing, fucks off. The Star Destroyers are crashing. Finn and Jaina are still on. They miss the transport because they stay behind to sacrifice themselves for the greater good. So this is actually an example of characters in Rise of Skywalker who are actually willing to sacrifice something, even if they don't end up sacrificing anything in the end anyway. So the Star Destroyer is going down. Finn and Jaina are sliding down the Star Destroyer, which you would probably think would be pretty hot due to all the fighting and all the low altitude flying. Poe races in his X-Wing in an attempt to save them before he is beaten to it by Lando and Chewie in the Falcon. It's a little unclear how Finn and Jaina got onto the Falcon. This is pretty much left up to imagination. Lando and Chewie just pull up and they somehow get in the Falcon without being injured or killed. But I guess they use the angle of the Star Destroyer as a slippery dip to jump and land on the back of the Falcon. But whatever. At this point in the film, it doesn't really matter because everything else has been bullshit. So, the Resistance has won. The Final Order has fallen. The Emperor has died again. The battle is over. And everyone is leaving Exegol and returning to their homes. One of the annoying things about the end of this film is no one really dies. Well, Lando didn't get killed in this one, which is good, I guess, because they pretty much killed all the other original trilogy heroes, so it's good to see Lando made it out alive. A majority of the Resistance characters do survive in this film. Snap Wexley gets the axe, and there's a few others, but no one of real importance gets killed in this film, which, being the final in the trilogy, you'd think the stakes would be a bit high and you think the sacrifice would be a bit greater, but there isn't really much sacrifice in this trilogy at all, especially in this film, as I've mentioned before. Unlike Lord of the Rings Return of the King, where sacrifice was the main theme of the film, a majority of good characters survive in that, but it's what they have to go through and what they have to give up in order to complete the mission that counts. None of the heroes really die in it, but there's still a great toll on individual characters. Each one of them has to sacrifice something in order to complete something or to gain something. I mean, the classic case is the Sam and Frodo story. The ring nearly kills Frodo. Sam has a great personal toll in trying to save Frodo. And even though Frodo isn't killed in it, He is unable to live normally again, and ultimately decides to leave Middle-earth with Gandalf and the elves. So this is a huge personal sacrifice for Frodo. With the Rise of Skywalker, there's none of that. It largely seems that the outnumbered and outgunned resistance don't really lose a hell of a lot of the central characters. They're already outnumbered 1,000 to 1, but somehow just as many of them return to base as left. Now compare that to The Last Jedi, whether you like the film or not. The resistance gets its ass kicked. There's a lot of transports that get annihilated, and there's very few survivors at the end of the film. It still shows the audience the weight of character choices. Holdo is no one's favourite character, but she sacrificed herself to save the remaining transports. Yeah, she left a little too late, but that's still a character sacrificing something for the greater good. In this, a few no-name pilots get taken out. Snap Wexley's about the only one that does get killed. And a couple of ground fighters, given the odds, it would seem that they would probably be annihilated and there'd be very few survivors, if any. However, this is a storytelling trait of George Lucas. Good guys win, bad guys lose. Always end the story on a happy note and keep the audience coming back and wanting more. So I guess you can't fault them for that. So, everyone leaves, Exegol is destroyed. They all set to celebrate back on the forest planet. They're all hugging and kissing each other. There's a very controversial lesbian kiss in this, because one of the resistance officers is, of course, a lesbian, to cover all the bases. That's another thing, I felt that all the diversity bases were covered in this film. It was blatantly on show in this film, just so it would make everybody happy. But all it really seemed to do was piss everybody off. You had all this nostalgia and all these old characters coming back into it, and all these apology scenes to service the true hardcore Star Wars fans. You had all the millennial shit, the thinly written and poorly designed new characters that fits with their millennial sense of entitlement. You have basically every denomination and minority covered in background characters. Don't give them leading roles, we just stick them in the background to make it look like we care, because that's the Disney way. There's also a very controversial lesbian kiss in it. It lasts for about 5 seconds and is pretty cringeworthy. This is just diversity for diversity's sake. Let's cover all the bases in it. It's shot very poorly. It's two women kissing for a couple of seconds, followed by two aliens shaking hands. I mean, great work, Disney. I think that just perfectly shows what Disney actually cared about in this trilogy. Appealing to diversity and political correctness over Star Wars fans and good storytelling. Oh look, we're Disney, we're so diverse, we care about the LGBTQ community. Nothing wrong with a lesbian kiss in a Star Wars film. If the scene was done properly, it probably would have been a really cool, really unique moment, but it wasn't. It just felt like everything else in this film, forced and appealing to one spectrum of fandom over another. So here's an idea, Lucasfilm and Disney. Just make a Star Wars film for Star Wars fans. And guess what? Star Wars fans are from all over the world. There's many different races, creeds, religions, and minorities. You chose to fuck with the formula, even though the formula was already perfect. There's a blatant Return of the Jedi celebration scene at the end of it, which covers the planets from the original trilogy. You see a Star Destroyer crashing behind Bespin. You see another Star Destroyer crashing in the sands of Jakku. That actually looked kind of cool. It would have been good if they had done that in the first film. It crashes behind the Star Destroyer that is already there. Which brings up another point, because one of the Resistance fighters mentions that this war begins where the last one ended, referring to Endor. That's incorrect, because the war went on after the events of Endor and the second Death Star being destroyed. The war finished a year later on Jakku, which is basically the opening to Force Awakens. So this is the level of consistency and credibility from Disney and Lucasfilm. You can't even get the facts of your own fucking film right. You destroyed the EU to replace it with your own canonized version of the EU, and you can't even get that right. The war ended on Jakku a year after Endor. The Outer Rims held on. there were still conflicts after that. They weren't as big, but the Empire was still not giving up. And yet you just must have forgotten that. One of the final celebration scenes is the Emperor's planet blowing up over Endor. You see an Ewok village and you see a couple of Ewoks. The camera goes down, you see the furry little ears. I do like Ewoks, they're cute. I don't know why everyone hates them. And you see Wicket and his wife. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is a cool scene, but this is just fan servicing. Let's put Ewoks in so we can have a little bit more of nostalgia-driven crap. So a couple of original fans might go, oh, cool, that's from the original. And to get the younger generation who probably haven't seen the originals to go, oh, yeah, cool, that's a furry little teddy bear. Let's make more toys of it and sell it. That whole kind of celebration scene felt like it was really just trying to appease old fans. It just played on nostalgia and was just very typical J.J. Abrams and typical Disney. So the film finally ends with Rey traveling to Tatooine. She visits the Lars homestead, Luke's home. It's been abandoned for several years. It's been filled up with sand. She has a look. Yeah, this is a cool little nod to the originals, a cool little nod to ending where it began. She looks around. She walks out into the desert. She has a piece of leather with Luke's lightsaber and Leia's lightsaber. This is very cool, very symbolic moment. She buries them both into the sand. This symbolizes the ending of the Skywalker saga, ending the journey where it began. However, you might be asking, why didn't she just take the lightsabers? That comes up a little later. An old lady with a bantha comes along and says to her, who are you? There hasn't been anyone here for years. She looks off into the distance and you see the ghosts of Luke and Leia standing side by side looking at her. So it's clear by this point in the movie that she's related to Palpatine. Obviously, she turns to the lady and she says, my name's Rey Skywalker. And then I proceeded to projectile vomit all over the theatre floor. Yeah, so she has adopted the name Skywalker. So rather than let Skywalker die with whatever little dignity is left with it, she then pulls out what looks like the end of the staff, stupid staff she's been carrying around the entire trilogy. She turns it on to reveal a yellow-bladed lightsaber. She has fashioned it out of her old scavenger staff. So this is a nice little symbol of her finally becoming a Jedi. So they've been calling her a Jedi for the last two films, and like I've always said, she wasn't a Jedi. She's not a Jedi until she's been taught, she's completed the trials, and she's made a lightsaber like every other fucking Jedi in the history of Star Wars has done. Now, she has finally accomplished this at the end of the trilogy. Now, wouldn't it have made more sense if she had done this at the start of the fucking film like Luke did with Return of the Jedi? They've copied Return of the Jedi so much, they might as well have just made the film with the plot of Return of the Jedi. So, rather than carry around Luke's blue lightsaber, for whatever reason they decided to put back in this film, even though it was destroyed in the previous film and you hadn't seen it again, that would have been the perfect opportunity for her to complete the trials, as you see in the start of Rise of Skywalker, make a lightsaber and become a Jedi before facing the Emperor. But for whatever fucking reason, this lightsaber is indestructible. It was lost in Bespin. It was found by Maz Kanata somewhere, in perfect condition, given to Rey. It's been thrown off of cliffs, been torn in half, and yet it's still functional. Yeah, it's a cool piece of symbology to bury in the sand to close out the Skywalker saga, but it makes no logical fucking sense. Her making the lightsaber at the start of the film would have changed the whole dynamic of her character. It would have shown that she was a Jedi rather than just some fuck girl running around pretending she's a Jedi with a hand-me-down lightsaber who hasn't completed the trials and has not been trained by a Jedi. They also should have brought Leia being a trained Jedi into it earlier, and then they could have had Leia finish Rey's training and pass the Jedi baton to her. But no, this would have been logical and common sense. So anyway, she steps up onto the homestead with BB-8 in tow. She looks out to the dual sunsets over Tatooine, and then the film ends. I give this film a 2.5 out of 5. It was average. It was messy. It was a fucking train wreck. It was all over the place. Questions got answered, but in the process, they just brought up more questions. The frantic editing and all the jump cuts made this movie messy, nonsensical, and non-logical. It was all over the place. It also fucked the entire pacing of the film. The pacing is all over the place. Sometimes it's fast, other times it slows right down, then it's fast again, then it's slow, then it's a medium pace, then it's fast again, then we come to the end and there's 20 minutes left, so let's just jam as much information in it as possible. I went in not expecting much, expecting to be underwhelmed, and it basically delivered. It was, like I said about Solo, it was frozen pizza. It was okay. A lot of things they brought up about the Palpatine bloodline didn't get answered. A lot of things they mentioned about Palpatine in general didn't really get answered. The biggest problem with Palpatine returning is that, for one, how the hell did he survive? There's no explanation as to how or why he survived. A lot of the things about Palpatine that are mentioned in the film don't get any explanation whatsoever. They're merely touched upon for a few seconds and then forgotten. And then we're on to the next thing. The frantic editing and pacing really only helped to derail this entire film. By far the biggest problem with bringing Palpatine back and the biggest problem with The Rise of Skywalker is that by bringing the Emperor back, you completely made the Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader sacrifice irrelevant. Everything that Vader sacrificed in Return of the Jedi is basically undone. It was all for nothing. He sacrificed himself to save his son, so what, his son could sit on an island for 20 years being an angry old prick and not helping or teaching the next generation of Jedi to combat a threat like Snoke. It really makes the whole Skywalker saga irrelevant. It destabilizes the original trilogy and the prequel trilogy. Vader's sacrifice is all for nothing. He sacrifices himself in order to save his son, and in the process kills the Emperor and frees the galaxy of his oppression and tyranny. Bringing the Emperor back only makes the Anakin Vader story and sacrifice completely irrelevant. Vader sacrifices himself, and all for what? The Emperor to come back 30 years later, bigger and better than ever? I mean, what was the point in destroying the Emperor if he can just come back time and time again? And all for what? So his son can teach the next generation of Jedi, have a falling out with his nephew, cut himself off from the Force, renounce the Jedi, and sit on an island for 20 years being a grumpy old prick, and for his daughter to lead another half-assed rebellion against another overpowered and tyrannical empire that everybody is too scared to come and help. The real message of the Anakin Vader story is that hope conquers fear and love conquers hate. This was the fundamental theme of the Anakin Vader story, and it has pretty much all been erased by the return of the Emperor. Fuck's sake, come on. I mean, they could have at least respected the source material just a little bit. Was this the Emperor's plan all along? I don't think so. I think this comes down to lazy and pathetic writing and not having a consistent idea for this trilogy in the first place. It really seems that Lucasfilm and Disney made it up as they went along. There was no overarching plan for this trilogy. Let's just come up with whatever we think will service the fans, whatever will make people happy and get them to spend money. I said I wasn't going to pay to see this movie, but yeah, I did. I had to see it because I wanted to do this review. I didn't want to give Disney money, and at the same time I thought, well, if I don't see it within the first day or two, it'll be ruined on Facebook, which it was ruined the night before I saw it. When someone posted a picture of with Rey standing on the homestead looking at the dual sunset, and it says, "I'm Rey Skywalker," and I thought, oh my god, they haven't seriously fucking done it. I also had to see it to confirm for myself just how bad it was going to be. So, the problems with The Rise of Skywalker didn't start with The Rise of Skywalker. They started with The Force Awakens and were completely exacerbated by The Last Jedi. The Force Awakens set up a lot of things that should have carried over for the next two films, but for whatever reason, most of those points were either ignored by Rian Johnson or completely discredited or disregarded entirely. Kylo probably should have kept his mask on. Snoke shouldn't have got killed, then we wouldn't have had to resurrect the Emperor and have a nonsensical and non-consistent story with the third and final act. One thing I did like that Rian Johnson did was making Rey's parents nobodies. I thought that was a cool idea. It was a way of broadening the Force user horizon. And this is something that the prequels have even touched on. You don't have to be a Skywalker to be a Jedi, as I've said before. That comes as no surprise because there was hundreds, thousands of Jedis at one point. I did like that. I didn't like that they had to rely on original trilogy characters to try and sell a new trilogy. They should have just gone with Rey's parents were nobodies. Yet JJ felt so strongly that that needed to be corrected in this film that he went and disregarded what Rian had. Someone really needed to be the bigger man and say, look, I respect what you did, I'll work around it. Clearly these two never met, they never collaborated with the writing, and that's why we're in this situation now. Hiring Colin Trevorrow to help write and even to direct was probably a mistake. I like the guy as a director, he's just a juvenile fucking writer. His plots and his stories come off like a fucking 15-year-old boy in creative writing class come up with the plot. The biggest problem with The Rise of Skywalker is The Last Jedi. Plain and simple, I don't think I have to go over it again. I did a 3.5-hour podcast review on The Last Jedi, so I think I've well and truly stated how I feel about that. That if you haven't heard it, you should go back and listen to that. One thing I will say in defense of The Last Jedi and Rian Johnson, he has recently said something along the lines of Star Wars films shouldn't just cater to the fans. And I think he's right, you have to be original. George Lucas knew this, he didn't try to make any Star Wars film the same as the last one. He did something completely different with the prequels and he got crucified for it. He tried something very different with The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones and people hated it. People are starting to appreciate the prequels more now, but this is probably why we're in the situation now. He didn't want to undertake another trilogy because he didn't feel like he had the time and he just didn't want to put himself in that position. Because fans are so critical of this new direction he went in. They wanted this nostalgic Star Wars they grew up with. So then Disney comes along, then Disney's like, oh, we'll give you the nostalgic fucking Star Wars you wanted. We'll just copy everything the originals did, repackage it, put unlikable characters in it, a piss-weak story, slap Star Wars on it, and sell it to you at a premium price. And guess what? We fell for it. Now, we're at the conclusion of this trilogy, and I feel unsatisfied. I'm still hungry. I knew Disney couldn't deliver. I knew they'd find a way to fuck it up, and they did. They relied on nostalgia, cliches, to sell us a product that we have already got. The product we've got was much better than the shit that they were trying to sell us, but we still brought it anyway. There's parts of The Last Jedi I hated, and there's parts of it I liked. The Last Jedi would have worked really well as a standalone Star Wars film. Say, as a standalone Star Wars film or a spin-off, The Last Jedi, a Star Wars story. It would have been perfect. It could have been original, it could have defied the expectations of fans or subversed the expectations of fans and done a whole dark and broody story of Luke on an island. Having The Last Jedi as it is, as the second part of a trilogy, pretty much made the third movie impossible to pull off. It was always going to be a mess. It was always going to be a total clusterfuck from the moment it started. The continuity, the ideas, and basically the originality were all dead by this stage. The Last Jedi ended too many plot points to be picked up in the third installment. Killing Snoke was a mistake. Killing Luke was a bigger mistake. Luke shouldn't have died on the fucking rocks on Ark 2. He should have confronted Kylo, come back, save the day, then been in the third one. At least give the guy the fucking decency to finish off his own trilogy. Luke needed to die in the third installment confronting the Emperor or Snoke. Not on a cliff on an island somewhere as a grumpy, angry old man. That would have been the perfect and most satisfactory conclusion to the Skywalker saga. The Last Jedi really should have been the third film, if anything. It ended so many plot points and so many story arcs in the second installment There's no way the third one could have picked him up coherently. The Last Jedi really only served to sabotage the third installment. It should have been the third film in the franchise, and not the second. Luke and Leia could have died happily. You could have closed out the Skywalker saga. Rey could have become a Jedi. Everyone could have gone home happy. Peace and love are restored to the galaxy. But I know Rian Johnson, Kathleen Kennedy, and no script supervisor saw to the destruction of Star Wars in the second installment. People will forgive you for the opening of a film. They might forgive you for the middle. Probably, undoubtedly, they're not going to forgive you for the end. But there is one other person that deserves just as much blame, and that is J.J. Abrams. J.J. more or less made a sequel to his own film. The Rise of Skywalker is the sequel to The Force Awakens, and not The Last Jedi. J.J. is equally at fault as Kathleen, Ryan, Lucasfilm, and Disney. He made a sequel to his own film, ignored a majority of the previous film, because it was far easier to answer the questions that he asked in the first film and not work around the story and events that happened in the previous film. So this concludes the saga of the greatest film franchise and story in history. Rather than going out like the originals or even the prequels, we got a clusterfuck of confusion. There's nothing memorable or really that likable that has come out of the trilogy. There's nothing really that good that has come out of the trilogy. The fault and the blame has to be put on to Kathleen Kennedy, the executives at Disney, Lucasfilm Story Group and Management, J.J. Abrams and Rian Johnson. Fuck the lot of you. You've ruined millions of childhoods, you selfish, fucking entitled cunts. You'd expect with the amount of money you've put into Star Wars you could have at least made a decent product, but oh no, that was too good. You had to fucking subvert expectations. You had to pander to political correctness and to gender politics. Fuck the lot of you, you hypocritical fucking cunts. And that concludes the Truth Tanks review of Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. Thank you to everyone who's listened. I hope you had a Merry Christmas and have a Happy New Year. If you're liking the Truth Tank, you can rate and review it. Leave a review on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcast provider. Subscribe to the Truth Tank on iTunes, Podbean. Follow the Facebook page. Spread the word. Tell your friends and co-workers about the Truth Tank. I aim to grow the Truth Tank in 2020, and I would really appreciate your help in doing so. If you can spread the word about the Truth Tank, help gather the fan base, that'd be much appreciated. All right, as always, I'm a tank. This is the truth. May the truth be with you.